so we'll turn the mic over to our LFO analyst, Mr. John Borden.
Thank you, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. This morning on the consent calendar for approval to apply for federal grants are seven items. Item number five, Commission on Children's and Families. Approval retroactively of submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention in the amount of $541,200 for Juvenile Accountability Block Grant. Item number seven, Department of Human Services. Approval retroactively, the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the amount of up to $200,000 per year for establishment of a state epidemiological outcomes work group to collect and analyze state data in order to ascertain the scope and extent of substance abuse and substance abuse-related problems in Oregon. Item number eight, Department of Human Services. Approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the amount of up to $325,000 per year for establishment of a strengthening treatment, assessment, and retention state implementation cooperative agreements to improve the state substance abuse treatment, access, and retention outcomes through improvement of provider services and clinical business practices. Item number nine, Department of Human Services. Approve the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the amount of up to $2.3 million per year for establishment of a strategic prevention framework state incentive grant program to be used for the prevention to prevent the onset and reduce the progression of substance abuse as well as increase community level prevention capacity. Item number four, Department of Agriculture. Approve the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Agriculture in an amount up to $300,000 for a nationwide program making funds available to states for specialty crop assistance. Item number 29, Department of State Lands. Approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Commerce, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in the amount of $245,000 for construction projects at the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve. And finally, item number 39, Water Resources Department. Approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation in the amount of $28,000 for the development of a guidebook to assist irrigation districts with the completion of required water management and conservation plans. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends en bloc approval of all seven federal grant application requests.
Are there questions relating to any of these federal grant application requests?
No, only just the comment, Mr. Chair, that should they receive approval, that the standard caveat that if their positions are in need for physician authority, that they will come back to this body to get that authority. Because I don't know whether positions are included in any of these grants.
If I may, Mr. Chair, my apologies. The instructions with the approval are that if the funds are awarded, the agency shall return to the Emergency Board or the Legislative Assembly for approval of any necessary federal funds or federal funds expenditure limitation and or position if the authority.
Okay. Just wanted that for the record.
All right. Thank you. I'm glad you bring that up. Please continue to bring it up when we need to. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move to consent to the request for the federal grant request contained in items 5, 7, 8, 9, 24, 29, and 39.
Representative Hanna moves that we consent to the request for federal grant request contained in items 5, 7, 8, 9, 24, 29, and 39. Is there objection? Hearing none. We consent to those requests. Our carrier for that, Representative Hanna. And we'll now move to agency reports. This is also for consent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. There are five agency reports. Item number six, Department of Human Services and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Acknowledge receipt of a report on the status of improving the utilization of available education benefits by Jobs Plus program participants as required by budget notes in Senate Bill 5584 and House Bill 5148. Please note that before the subcommittee is a memorandum from the Legislative Fiscal Office with updated information related to paragraph 2 of this particular item. Item number 40.
Mr. Chair, stand by. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Jobs Plus piece, and I don't know the appropriateness of this at the moment in terms of where we are here. Can you answer if there's a history of this Jobs Plus surplus funding transferring to other funds? Can you answer to the history of that?
Mr. Gordon.
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, maybe I would defer to Steve Bender of the Legislative Fiscal Office, who is here, as well as there are two agency representatives from DHS, as well as from the Commission, Peggy Cooksey and Dennis Johnson.
Rather than continue with the others, why don't we go ahead and deal with questions relating to Jobs Plus at this time. Would the three of you please come forward?
Are you okay with that?
Sure.
Okay.
John?
Thank
Good morning.
You, Mr. Chair and members. The history of the use of the allocation of funds in the Jobs Plus account to other uses is as follows. And in all cases, this was done by act of the legislature. In 2002, approximately $1.7 million of funds were transferred for use for uses of the Department of Human Services to finance program expenditures in that department. There was also a transfer of approximately $2.6 million to DHS other funds in fiscal year 2005-06 that was used for that purpose. And finally, in the
2000...
Mr. Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 2.6 was just to other funds?
Yes, for DHS.
DHS.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And finally, in 2003-05 biennium, as part of the budget of that biennium, the legislature transferred other funds balances from a number of agencies to the general fund. And in that particular instance, there was a transfer to the general fund of approximately, $674,000 to the state general fund.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Having some history there, my concern, Mr. Chair, is simply that this is job training money, or what it appears to be, and to underutilize it and then just push it off to take care of costs somewhere else is somewhat of a concern to me.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winter.
The Jobs Plus, the underutilization of Jobs Plus money, there's been a lot of discussion as to, in previous sessions, as to why. And it's kind of interesting that one of them is, one of the outcomes is that employers probably, if they have an employee, will go ahead and pay for training, and so therefore this pot has been underutilized ever since the creation of the program.
Mm-hmm. Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning.
Good morning.
I have a little history with this program as well, going back to the 90s, working with then Representative Durfler, when we were both members of the House and working to shape his proposal for Jobs Plus. I've had a long-standing interest in the program and concern about implementation and outcomes. With that said, ineffective marketing of the IEA portion of the program has been a problem since the beginning of the program, and so that's why participants haven't used the education benefit, ineffective marketing. Now we have a work group established by DHS and the Oregon Student Assistant Assistance Association to study the IEA underutilization. My questions are, who serves on the work group? How many times has that work group met since the legislature adjourned? And are there any marketing experts on the group, on that work group? Again, ineffective marketing has been at the crux of the problem.
Mm-hmm. So are you able to answer those questions as far as the work group, who's on it? And
I could answer some of those questions. I do believe, however, that representatives of the agencies would be able to answer all of those questions for this subcommittee.
All right. So we've invited two representatives to come up. I don't know if Peggy Cooksey is here or Jim Neely. Are either one of you? Or anyone else that represents the agency could let us know what's going on. Thank you for coming forward. Just identify yourself and let's get to the bottom of this.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Lida. I'm the TANF manager for DHS.
And my name is Dennis Thompson. I'm executive director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
Was it Thompson?
Johnson.
Johnson, excuse me. Thank you. Were you able to hear the questions that Senator Gordley has asked about the committee and its makeup, the functioning, and whether or not marketing is being part of the agenda for the committee?
Yes.
Yes, right.
Do you want to take it? Specifically, the group has met twice, beginning in January of this year. The members of the committee include a Jobs Plus analyst from DHS, and I believe Dennis was at the initial meeting, but not the second meeting,
correct,
from my understanding. And then the grants director and the grant staff person from OSAC also attended those meetings.
Okay. Anyone else?
No, that's...
All right, so we do have a program that would provide education to those that are tremendously in need of it. There's funding for it. We are missing our participants. And if the Senator is correct that it's a problem of lack of knowledge of the availability, a marketing issue, then would it not be appropriate that there be on the committee or invited to the committee those that have expertise in that area?
Perhaps I can address that. I began my appointment in January, so it was with a fresh set of eyes that I could look at this program and learn about the history from others. It appears that over 27,000 people have gone through the program, 8,000 of them DHS clients and 19,000 Employment Department unemployment insurance claimants. So it's a huge universe of potential users here. And the difficulty seems to be in at the front end, getting in touch with people. It's a very mobile population, and no one seems to have accurate addresses, good lists within a few months of individuals completing the program. So that's, you know, a first thing. It may just be difficulty not necessarily in crafting a message, but in getting it to the individuals. And that's what we've been working on. How do you clean up lists? How do you get the information from DHS so that we can reach the individuals with potential benefit?
Yeah. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This continues to be a frustrating issue. It surfaces every session, and the responses that we get about the need to do a better job or more effective job of marketing the program continue to be unsatisfactory. Again, what I am not hearing addressed specifically is that there are people on the group, on the work group, who have marketing expertise. I need to hear more, if it's being discussed at all, what marketing strategies are being discussed to get information about the education benefit out to the constituency who could benefit from the information. The clients are known. The clients are in a database. So the suggestion that we can't find them, which is how I'm hearing what you've expressed, just doesn't fly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, one of the strategies that we're using, we just began, is doing additional follow-up letters directly with those clients, a series of letters about every 3 months for folks that do not respond. Part of that process is to do some more work on verifying addresses for return letters and trying to do some additional follow-up on that.
One thing we'd request would be if you'd come back in June for just a 5-minute report and just let us know what what progress is being made in this area and what changes are taking place. For instance, inviting those that have marketing expertise or checking with other states or doing what additional work can be done to see if we can reach out to those that would benefit most from the program.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry I had to go out of the room. But would you also bring back what your relationship or interaction that you're having with employers as well as employees? Because employers also may not know that this benefit is available for their employees.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. They might be good people to really promote it with their employees. Mm-hmm. Are there further questions or comments on this? Thank you very much for the clarification, and welcome aboard, Mr. Johnson, and we're glad to be there.
Continuing with the consent report, item number 43, Department of Transportation, acknowledge receipt of the first of two interim reports on implementation of the Oregon Innovative Partnership Program. Mm-hmm. Item number 44, Department of Consumer and Business Services, acknowledge receipt of a report on the federally funded Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program. Item number 46, Public Employees Retirement System, acknowledge receipt of a report on the preliminary crediting of 2005 earnings received through investment of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund regular account as required by ORS 238-670-5. Item number 47, Department of Administrative Services, acknowledge receipt of a report describing compensation plan changes submitted as required by ORS 291-371. The legislative fiscal recommends acknowledging receipt of all five agency reports.
Discussion on any of the reports? Chair would accept a motion for a receipt.
I so move with the caveat of the request to the department on the Jobs Plus.
Okay. Senator Winters moves that the committee accept the agency reports relating to items 6, 43, 44, 46, and 47, and also that we'll be getting a report in the June session of this subcommittee. Is there objection? Hearing none, your reports are accepted. And the carrier, Senator Winters? Thank you. All right, thank you. We'll now move on to agency requests. I might mention at this time that between numbers 11 and 12, I'm going to be inviting, the committee will be inviting to hear special testimony from Jan Krall, who's from Shangri-La, relating to DD provider reimbursement issues, which we just want a brief update on what's happening in that area. And we'll begin with item number 10. We'll welcome you, Mr. Britton. And we would invite representatives from the Department of Human Services to come up relating to the report to improve Oregon State Hospital patient safety and care, and the analyst also.
Because you're going far left.
Good morning, Director Nickel, Mr. Moore. Would you like to go ahead and lead out, Bob?
Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Richardson. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel. I'm the Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I have responsibility for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. You have the report that we prepared, and I'm prepared to provide an update on items since, because of timelines, to get materials ready to submit. The information you have now is probably about 6 weeks behind, so a lot has happened in that period of time. I think the key thing here to keep in mind is that we have four different aspects of the projects that we're working on. The first one has to do with the movement of 100 patients from the 41 units in the J building at the State Hospital. As you recall, the Phase 1 OSH Master Plan pointed out that in case of an earthquake, there would likely be a collapse of that particular part of the building, which is up to 100 and almost 130 years old in some places. Now, it's been updated in some respects, but the seismic vulnerability of that particular part of the building is a major concern. We have reviewed the Cedar Hills facility at the suggestion of the chair, and also Dr. Goldberg asked us to work closely with DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, to see about the feasibility and the timeline for using what at least appeared to be a possibility at the Cedar Hills building. We were advised after talking with the Department of Administrative Services that the timelines were such and the potential costs were such that they advised us not to proceed further with that. So there's been a little bit of a delay, but we're moving forward with the Portland remodel campus, remodel of the sixth floor of that campus. We will be putting out a construction bid here shortly. We hope to, I mean, the bottom line is that it's still going to take some time, but we think that we'll be able to move 24 patients in about a year from now. I hesitate to give real specific timelines because there are a lot of steps that have to take place here, but the key issue here is to bring this project in at or below the allocation level that we were provided. We have a construction estimate that's been provided by our architectural engineer firm, Peck Smiley Etlin, PSE, and we are working now to put together the request for proposal and get an actual construction project going. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that.
Okay. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, as I read through this information, I know that we spent some time. We toured the facility. I know that the chair and the director went and looked at the Cedar Hill facility to you know, vet out could that work and so forth. We had a lot of discussion about the sixth floor being leased for a number of years, and we hadn't done anything with it. And so it seemed as though we were asking some fairly pointed questions about, you know, everything to do with that, that especially as folks who were coming from the outside in trying to learn the whole system and get caught up to it. And then when I came up actually to Salem on Monday and I printed my packet and I began to read through all of this, and I read where DAS actually renewed the lease for that facility in June of 05. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that is correct.
And so that's probably after we toured the facility and or before, and we were still going out looking at Cedar Hills and so on, but I don't know, it just surprised me that we had renewed the lease on that facility and we were out looking at the other one as well, and I don't know if it was just me that missed that point.
Actually,
that we had moved forward with that or
I
not.
I can interject that what was told to the subcommittee during the hearings was that the original lease, well, this didn't come up till October.
Okay.
This came up in the fall. Okay. We were told that the original lease was executed in 1995, and that it had been renewed for another 10 years, but it didn't come up really until our October subcommittee.
After. Okay.
So it was after that.
Okay. All right.
clarifies things, Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I think we've worked hard at this, and I was concerned that we'd done all of that and then we'd moved ahead. Then in that paragraph, just as a follow-up, we can all take a deep breath. The changes in the lease resulted in increased costs for the facility of $800,000 general fund. Is that per biennium? Or is that per year? Or is that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that's per biennium.
That's additional rent. The rent went up for the new lease.
So the rent went up $400,000 a year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that would be my understanding, and not surprising since the earlier lease had been executed 10 years earlier. It's, things do increase.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Nickel?
No, but it does raise some timing. Representative Hanna does raise some timing issues in that we're making some decisions or we're having some discussions on an issue when things have already have occurred. And the other one, even though there's been a 10-year gap, as I'm assuming that the remodeling costs will be borne by the state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, we did try to negotiate that into the lease arrangement, but there was not a willingness on the part of the legacy group to do that. So we had thought of that, and that would have been something we would have been attracted to, but we were not able to negotiate that.
My question is, DAS here to say, what do you do the negotiations, or does DAS, because they have supposedly the experts in the field to do that kind of negotiation? Who actually does the negotiation with the owner of the property?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it's really a team effort where we work together with DAS on that.
The senator is pointing out that we're about to do at least a $2.1 million remodel on a building with no participation by the owner of the building, and so we're raising the value of that asset by that kind of money, and there's been no no participation, which normally would not be business, acceptable for those that are paying the money.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I recognize the issue you're bringing up, and we did try to deal with it, but we were not able to get to that negotiation in the way that we would have preferred to do it. And, frankly, it requires obviously two parties to get there.
Sure. Further comments or questions?
Mr. Chair. I just want to be sure I understand it. We have a building with 130 people in it that if there's an earthquake, it's going to collapse, we think, and we're going to move out 24 in a year. Are we going to get that thing emptied out before that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, there is another part of the plan that I haven't gotten to yet.
Okay.
So, yeah, you're right. This would get 24 patients out of that building. Maybe I should just continue and go into the other. The other part of the plan would be to reduce the census in forensics by 70 patients, and that would get us to the number that we need to be, roughly closely enough that we could then close each one of those units as we reduce the population by 24 and then 70. The 70, we received approval from the legislature from the e-board to begin a process to create a combination of additional residential programs and also what we call supported intensive forensic case management services. So we're well on our way to negotiating with four or five counties who've stepped forward and very interested in working with us to take people out. The PSRB, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, is working with us on that, and we hope to have some of those projects started by the end of April or early May. So we are moving forward with those. The advantage of the assertive case management projects is that since they don't involve facility development, they're much faster. It's really a matter of negotiating an agreement, a plan amendment with the counties that are involved, them hiring staff, getting them trained enough that they can begin to take people who are ready for less than 24-hour supervised care but live intensively supervised in community settings. It's also a much more cost-effective way of going about this rather than always relying on residential or hospital level of care. So that's the other strategy here. That also dovetails with a settlement agreement that we've entered into with the Oregon Advocacy Center around a lawsuit that has to do with understaffing and overcrowding in the state hospital. So we're really going to be dealing with two different issues here with that part of the proposal.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordon.
You mentioned the settlement. The timeline on that settlement runs to when?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordon, the overall settlement has a lot of different aspects to it, but it will run through the end of this biennium, and then, you know, given what happens with the conversation with the governor's budget and the legislature, we hope to be able to continue all of that. But I think that we have a settlement agreement that's very reasonable for us. It really follows the kind of policy lines that we would like to work with, and we're working closely with the Psychiatric Security Review Board on all of this because they ultimately control, as you know, the release, the actual release of forensic patients into the community.
So the state is in line with our agreement in the settlement, and we're on track.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Please continue.
Other parts of the report describe not only the remodel of the State Hospital Portland campus on the sixth floor, the developing 71 community placements, but also the additional funding that we received approval for to hire 30 additional clinical positions at OSH. And the issue here is not so much the overcrowding issue or the 100 patients who are in the J building, but the ratio of staff to patients in the forensic units. We have known for some time and have placed on the record that, in our view, we were about 30% understaffed compared to comparable hospitals, say Western Washington State Hospital. The advocates brought in a nationally known consultant, entered a lawsuit that would have required us to get that ratio up to, if I remember correctly, 1.35 forensic staff for every patient. That is the goal in part here, to hire 30 additional staff. When I first saw the proposal from the state hospital on this, I wanted to make sure that hiring 30 clinical staff was the right direction to go. And I became convinced that in order to run the kind of treatment programs, we did need to hire more psychiatrists, 6 more psychologists, 4 more rehabilitation therapists, 4 more occupational therapists, and I believe 4 more social workers and then the balance of the positions would be for what we call mental health specialists, which are essentially master's level positions. So that 30, those 30 additional positions will really enhance the clinical capability of our forensic program to provide the treatment that the Psychiatric Security Review Board needs in order to feel comfortable that the patients have been treated and are truly ready for a safe release into the community. So that process is well underway. Excuse me.
Senator Winters.
I can appreciate the treatment and clinical need, but I'm also concerned as to whether or not it's the staffing level to prevent some of the patient abuse and some things that happen to some of the other staff who may not be the psychiatrist or that level of staffing. The ones where, you know, and I've been concerned for years, as you know, about the high rate of workers' comp injuries. And what about that? Those staff, are you talking about looking at the ability to have sufficient staff so that individuals like the one that was badly injured last year doesn't occur?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, I'm well aware of your concern and others' concerns about that. The reduction of census in combination with the increase in staff and continued training for staff on safety issues will, I believe, show a significant decrease in the rate of staff and patient injury and any kind of abuse issues that have come up.
You know, I would like to see, just as you had the staff ratio for the clinical treatment side, the same kind of information back to us on the staffing ratio for that level as well, because I'm very concerned. You have some individuals who are there who are working 24 hours who may not be the masters, who may not be the psychiatrists, but are in danger. You know, they're doing the hands-on on work, if you will. And if we don't have a good ratio there, we're putting them at risk. So
can you determine that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, we'll get that information for you.
Also, although it's a little extra work, would you also let us know how that compares with mm-hmm. whether it's national standards or our neighboring states, just so that we can get a sense of what it really means?
Sure, we'll do that. I can add that in the OSH Master Plan report, they looked at other states, and the comparison for the daily cost of care, which is largely driven by staffing, of course, in a psychiatric hospital, not by technology so much, it's clear that our hospital, which runs about $360 a day, is far below the averages in Utah, Washington, and the other states that were looked at, which were around $500 a day. Some of that information is in the OSH Master Plan Phase 2 report. And one reason I want to mention it is because as we talk about these issues of staffing are critical. If we build a new state hospital and we keep the same kind of staffing that we have now, I think we're going to end up with at least some of the same kind of issues that we've got.
Mr. Chair, the desire is to bring on 30 positions and to do a national search. Timeline, please. How quickly do you think this can be accomplished?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
are the people out? What do we know about whether the quality of professionals that we're looking for are out there? What barriers, what challenges are we going to be looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, I asked for an update. And so as of yesterday, I can tell you that all of the positions are in recruitment and they have been posted since February of 2006. We have two social work positions open. We have four external candidates. There are no internal candidates. And the reason I mention that is when you have internal candidates, it delays the actual increase in the staffing ratio because of the bargaining agreement and because of the opportunity for internal promotions. You end up with kind of a domino effect, which delays this process. But at this point, we have two social work positions. The interviews are scheduled for this week. There are four external candidates. So I think in that category, we're in good shape, and we'll move quickly on that. Well, there are four teachers. I neglected to mention that that's part of what we need here is to beef up the education portion of what we're doing to help people who are there get the education that they need to get on with their lives. We have four external candidates for four positions. Those interviews are scheduled for April 10th. We have four occupational therapist positions open. There is one internal candidate, and there are three supported employment education candidates. Psychologists, this is the area where we're struggling, frankly. Licensed psychologists is what we need, and we have only one internal candidate and no external candidates. We've been aware for some time that the pay scale that we have for licensed, these are PhD psychologists, doctoral level psychologists, this is very difficult work in a difficult environment, and frankly, most licensed psychologists can find easier ways to make more money. So that's an area we are struggling with right now. And we'll continue to do every kind of recruitment we can, but that's the biggest area of concern.
Would it be appropriate for us to be provided with information as to what's being paid elsewhere, where we stand, and we have a duty to assure that you can do your job. And if you are having your hands tied because we cannot pay a fair and competitive rate, we need to know that in a way that we can actually present it to the legislature and try and deal with that reality in our next session.
Mr. Chair, I want you to know we really appreciate that, and we will get that information. What staff is telling me right now is it looks like, just from what they know, that we're about $30,000 a year underpriced for similar kinds of positions. So we've got quite a big gap there, and I think the fact that we have only one candidate says that, you know, there's really a serious problem there. So we will bring that.
Every employer knows that's how you help. If you have a job request or an opportunity, you only get one application, you're paying too little or your benefits aren't good. If you get two or more, then you know that you're competitive, or at least you're mm-hmm. you're in the ballpark. And so you've given us an indication, and we just need to have more data.
Mr. Chair, we'll get that more specific data for you. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had another subject to get in on, but I have to disagree with that comment. First of all, if in my opinion you're going to decide whether you're at the right place for the folks you have coming for jobs, one is, if you're going to give us the information, tell us the top one or two, three reasons why people leave their job. And if it's transferring out to other jobs, that helps us get an indication. But if they're leaving because of retirement or promotion within the same division, you might find that they actually like their jobs and feel well paid and their benefits are good. And it could just be the pool of folks out there is a little bit lacking. So I would say we don't want to jump to that conclusion from my standpoint anyway. I want to ask a question related to the new positions. I'm referencing the letter written to the e-board from the director. It goes through a number of the positions. It says within mental health, higher than budgeted costs for Oregon State Hospital. It's on page 11, and it talks about the new positions, 16 positions to resolve the double fill.
This is in the rebalance, and so we're kind of jumping ahead to some of the information.
Well,
in
I just,
that, in that
yeah.
item, so they know where you're talking
okay.
about.
But I want to understand if that's part of the 30. Are the 16 positions that you reference in that letter part of the 30 new positions, or are they additional positions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I believe that they are new. They are not included in the 16, but I would have to go back and look at the detail.
Okay, and maybe we're going to get to that, but I...
16 is not included in the
16 30. Is not part of the 30. The 30 is specifically to the Salem campus?
That's, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct.
Okay, yes. And the 16 are for Eastern Oregon?
That would be correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I did have a follow-up.
Senator Gordon.
If I may. Thank you. Mr. Nickel, it would also be helpful to know what the education pipeline looks like with regard to numbers of folks being trained to come and work in these areas, the education pipeline in Oregon.
Supply and demand?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I appreciate the question, too, because that's another area of a big concern we have is the whole issue of behavioral workforce development, and I have an initiative on that. We're working with Oregon Health and Science University. We're working with Portland State, Oregon State University. And partly what we believe at this point is, aside from the issue of numbers, which is an important one, are people really being trained to do the kind of work that we need in the public behavioral health system? And I think the answer all around the corner is that there are areas for improvement there, definitely.
Further questions or comments?
Okay. Mr. Chair, just continuing on quickly, we have 6 mental health specialist positions. These are the master's level counseling and social work kinds of levels. We have 6 positions open. We have 1 or 2 internal candidates, and we have 28 external candidates. So on that one, we're in very good shape, and I'm really pleased to see that. Rehabilitation therapists, we have 5 internal candidates and only 1 external candidate for 4 positions. And finally, physicians, we are holding interviews with 2 candidates this week, talking with a 3rd next week, so we have, and they're all external candidates. If we were to fill all of those 4 positions, we'll still be working 4 positions short. So this has been an ongoing area of concern. We're doing national recruitment. We're meeting next week with Oregon Health and Science University to talk with them about how we can partner more together to work on recruitment issues. So I think we've got some things to do here, but we've got some good ideas about how to do that.
Okay. One comment on your, I think you said that in Oregon the cost per day was it 360?
Mr. Chair, approximately, yes.
Okay, and that other states are at 500. I don't know how you determine that. When we were actually considering the budgets, we were looking at the total number of patients served by the total cost of the program, and at 360, that's about $131,000 a year per patient. At $500 a day, it's about $182,000 per patient. The cost to maintain the programs were between $250,000 and $275,000 per patient if you took the total cost and divided by the number of patients. And so I got a feeling we have a definitional kind of thing. It's what goes into a determining a cost per day.
Mr. Chair, we can have further discussion to try to get some of those at least apparent discrepancies straightened out, because we want to make sure we're transparent about these things. So if we can get you more information on that, or if we could talk at some point, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions or comments relating to the report? Chair would accept the motion, accept the report.
So moved.
Okay. Senator Gordley has moved that we accept item 10 report relating to the state, the Oregon State Hospital patient safety and care. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none. Thank you for your report. Next item is number 11.
Mr. Chairman,
good morning.
Committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, and I invited Catherine White to join me today. We had a budget note from the last session directing us to take a comprehensive look at services for children with disabilities and look at a much broader array of support for both kids with disabilities and their families. Just by way of quick background, in 1997, I believe it was, we made a decision within the department that was approved by the legislature to transfer responsibility for kids with disabilities out of the child welfare arena into the developmental disabilities arena. And the emphasis at that time was to begin looking at a much broader array of services and not simply become a crisis system, which was the natural orientation within child welfare for those kids and those families. And unfortunately, 10 years later, the number of kids we serve in residential and foster care has grown by leaps and bounds. I think we started in the mid-90s with about 300 kids in residential and foster care. We have over 800 children now in residential and foster care, while the number of families getting family support in their own homes has remained relatively constant. And in fact, there were some reductions, budget reductions in that program. We also have a group of kids that are growing up in nursing homes, not a large number of kids, it's under 100, but nonetheless they've been in nursing homes simply because their families haven't been given support or we haven't developed foster care or other out-of-home settings for them. And every one of those kids have identical twins, either in natural family homes or in community residential settings. So that's an issue that the steering committee on is addressing. We also have, from the last session, a major initiative that we're working on regarding the potential involvement of kids with disabilities in the Psychiatric Security Review Board process. In the last session, legislation was passed that will phase in kids with mental illness that can invoke the defense not guilty by reason of mental defect and then have a dispositional route through the juvenile courts into the department to receive services and address their security needs. We did not include children with developmental disabilities. That's part of this study for the next biennium that we have to come back with recommendations. We're still fairly early in this process, and the recommendations are not fully formed at this point in time. Particularly on the PSRB and the kids issue, what we're addressing and grappling with is how the department, if we assume this responsibility, will deal with closed custody. We have no security or lockup for kids with disabilities in the department. And those kids now typically go into the Oregon Youth Authority, into the general population. If that program comes to the department, juvenile courts can directly commit kids to the department under that defense. We will have to develop closed custody capacity. And so we're looking at all of our different options for doing that, as well as what definition of developmental disability would be in that. On the nursing facility side, we believe we can develop alternatives and probably do it within existing resources so that we can begin, A, to divert kids who otherwise shouldn't have to go, and then develop alternatives working with families who have children in those settings now. We have some opportunities under the new Deficit Reduction Act recently passed by Congress. It will allow families with children with disabilities up to 300% of the federal poverty level to apply for Medicaid and do a Medicaid buy-in type program so they hopefully can get insurance. Part of the problem we get kids both in nursing homes or in out-of-home settings is if a child has very significant medical needs or equipment needs and the family blows its insurance cap, Either they have to impoverish themselves to get medical support, or if they place their child in an out-of-home setting, we pick that child up under Medicaid. So if there's some way through a waiver or a Medicaid buy-in approach that we can allow families to keep their sons and daughters at home, pay in, and get that kind of insurance and get the equipment and expensive care covered, we can mitigate much of the out-of-home placement problem. With that, I'll just yield to Catherine for a moment and then respond to questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, and we were a part of the budget note. And from an advocacy perspective, obviously nothing ever seems to move as quickly as we would like to have it move. But I just wanted to fill you in on what the committee has been doing and some of the other things that are going on. We've been meeting at monthly, sometimes twice a month, with meetings between our scheduled meetings to talk to people on the ground who are providing the services. So we've met with foster care folks. We've met with the people who do residential services. We've met with people who work with families who have medically fragile children to get a sense of what's really happening, not just looking at the data. This is a system that has incredible hydraulics, is what we've learned, and we're dealing with county programs, state-run programs, and regionally-run programs. And so the complexity of how that all fits together is something that we've been looking at and gathering the data on. We've spent a lot of time looking at data and trying to figure out who kids are. We have, as I say, met with a lot of different groups. We've looked at and heard about things that appear to be real demographic changes in terms of the system dealing with a lot more kids with complex adolescents with complex mental health as well as developmental disability issues. And for the system that's been sort of a traditional developmental disability system, this has challenged the providers of services and challenged the system. So we've been looking at that. That led us to looking at eligibility, which directed us to having people run some scrutiny of case files to see who's coming into the system, why they're coming into the system. So I guess I would just say that one of the things we've been doing has been a lot of testing of our assumptions. I mean, some of the advocates came into this process with some very specific assumptions on what was happening, and what we've been doing is testing a lot of those assumptions. We've been looking at the waivers that currently exist and what our options are to expand some of those waivers and pick up kids who are receiving intensive supports but are not getting a Medicaid match for those supports. We've been looking at that. We do have a little group that has started now to look specifically at developing some kind of waiver that would help divert kids from foster care and from nursing homes and address those kids that are medically involved and try and keep them out of the system. And as Mr. Taves mentioned, we are looking at the Family Opportunity Act. We are also tracking the children's health care initiatives and how that could be combined in terms of family participation. In the process, we are also looking at the issues where there is what appears to be less than effective collaboration between agencies, duplication potentially, et cetera. So in the report that you will receive, all of these issues will be highlighted. And I guess I would just say that some of the members of the steering committee would welcome the opportunity to meet with anyone anytime to talk about these issues. This is something we care very passionately about.
We know that, and that's admirable. This budget note gives a tremendous opportunity for major change, but what we're getting is a kind of a progress report. The budget note actually says the group shall review eligibility, demographics, funding options, program design, administration, implementation, and best practices, and then in early 2006, which is now, come forward with their findings and recommendations for implementation of a comprehensive integrated system of services and supports. Do you have a comprehensive plan of recommendations for us at this time? It sounds like it's more complicated than you've been able to handle in the time frame that you've had, and that you need more time.
Mr. Chairman, I can address that. Even at the time the budget note was authored, and Ms. White will recall, we had some interactions in terms of our ability to develop really that comprehensive a system review within those time frames. I think, in fairness to the advocates, they felt very strongly we needed to bring at least some items forward into the budget cycle, and if we didn't set a marker early in the biennium.
$1.21. Thank you for catching that. I apologize. So what you see, though, is that we pay $9.74 as an average, and that's because we don't pay good benefits. That's because we defer our maintenance, and because we've frozen our wages. It's not because that our communities are making up the difference for the state. I wanted to make that point. Thank you for bringing that up. So continuing through there, then you see that the COLA, and then the last page is just a reflection of some of the contributions that the comprehensive DD system makes in our communities. It's really the cornerstone, in my opinion, of all of the DD services that we provide, because we're part of that network with our case management and our counties, and certainly with the other services that are evolving. So you see that there are hundreds of millions of dollars in assets that are owned by communities. DD providers. Community programs raise a minimum of $8 to $10 million annually in grants and cash. This money cannot be used to offset direct care wages or rates that we get, because those are supposed to be inclusive rates that come to us. So we use them maybe to buy vehicles or to do special projects. I won't go through each of these things, but I think that all of you are aware from your own involvement in your own communities about the tremendous contribution. We have something that just came to us the day before yesterday that I think may be useful to you, and I don't have any more detail than what I'm providing you here, but it is a study that came out of California about workers in homes, not in group homes. But it says that the findings were that when wages are competitive and benefits are provided, consumers are more likely to find someone who wants to work in this kind of job. It's a phenomenal concept, but it does point out that when wages rose to $10 an hour and health and dental insurance became available, people who worked 35 hours a month, the turnover rate dropped dramatically to 26% from about 60%. So I think that's compelling for us to at least consider, even though it's not in our own state. Thank you so much for the opportunity to address this. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Questions?
No questions, but I wish that others could have been at the rally yesterday to see the approximately 400 individuals there, both the staff as well as individuals who receive care, and their compelling stories of what it really means. And I reminded my colleagues that the state, when we entered into a partnership, and I like to use the word partnership because it was to be a partnership between the state and the private nonprofits, a promise to provide the care, and that the responsibility of the state when we downsized Fairview, there were certain commitments that were made. And if you listen to the testimony that was given, and if you look at the facts that are here, we haven't kept that commitment. If you listen to the staff, those who, some of them were in tears, who actually were committed and enjoyed the work that they do, but they have to seek employment someplace else because they can't afford to give the care. And then when you think in terms of trying to provide a family of your own on $9 or $9.74 an hour, it puts it all really into a perspective. And so I just would hope that we go through this and really take a really hard look at what we're asking our partners to do without giving them just compensation. Because the question in my mind was, what would happen if we didn't have the Shangri-Las and the Abitina Kerrs and those partners out there in the community to assist us in caring for the individuals that we have said by law that we're committed to if they were not there. So I just would like for us, as we go through these deliberations, to be ever so mindful that we make commitments, and I think it's our responsibility to assure that these employees and this partnership that we have, that we honor that. So I just had to put that on record.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We have a tremendous responsibility to make sure that the care is available, and this is not something that we want to have the state have to assume more and more responsibility for. And so we are talking about private enterprise and assuring that there is a parity or a fairness as far as the pay that is made, whether it's public sector or private sector. And with 65% turnover, that's an indication of a huge problem. And so we appreciate you bringing forward the information. And we want to continue to remember that this is an issue that must be addressed. Any further questions? Thank you for coming forward.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you for all the work you do. You represent these hundreds and hundreds of people who are committed to this kind of work. This is extremely challenging work, and it takes a special heart and a special attitude to be able to share of oneself day after day. And we understand that. We appreciate that. And, I mean, words can't express the effect that loving and competent care means to this whole population, people that need so much. So we thank you for it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Next item. Number 12, Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit update.
Do we need to accept that report?
Do you need to accept that report?
Mm-hmm. Or is it just testimony?
Are you going down?
Yeah, we can just go on down and accept them all.
Hers
was just testimony, not actually. She was just between 11 and 12, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought she was 12.
Okay. Good morning.
Thank you.
Chairman Richardson, members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteance. I'm the Oregon Department of Human Services Medicare Modernization Act Project Manager. And I'm here to give you an update on how things are going. I spoke in January briefly about some of the problems that we were facing, and I'm here to say that problems got worse, and now they're getting better. We did see significant number of problems during January and February where clients were not receiving their Medicare prescription drugs because of a variety of federal problems. And with a lot of work with the Area Agencies on Aging, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association, individual pharmacies, many of the prescription drug plans, a lot of them that are homegrown here in Oregon, and the federal government, we've resolved a lot of those problems for our clients. But problems still remain, and we believe that those problems will be ongoing. CMS will fix its problems, and we're hoping that as we progress into this first year of this brand new program, that every month things will get a little better. But there will always be problems for our clients because of the design of the program. And I wanted to just highlight a couple of those issues. One of the problems is ongoing enrollment changes. The dual-eligible individuals, those that have both Medicare and Medicaid, are able to change plans every single month. And as new clients come in, they then enroll in a plan. And those enrollment changes will cause problems because the systems can't keep up with the turnover. Just like any type of national program or even state program that relies on computers to transmit data back and forth, that will never happen instantaneously. Well, at least probably not in the next 4 or 5 years. Maybe technology will catch up and we will actually be able to do that. But at least in the foreseeable future, the enrollment problems that clients cannot prove that they're in a plan, that they've changed plans, and no one knows which plan they're really in, will continue to be a problem, we believe, for at least the next year. There's also a problem, an ongoing problem with the federal government. We tell them who our clients are, and then they then tell the prescription drug plans how much to charge that individual. And as you remember, full benefit dual eligible individuals either pay between $1 and $5 copayments for all their drugs and usually don't pay a premium. And we're continuing to see a problem where the federal government cannot tell the plans how much to charge people correctly. And we are working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to try to get that information corrected, to figure out where the breakdown is, and get that resolved so that our clients are only charged the amount that they're supposed to be charged. Because what's happening right now is for many of our clients, they show up at the pharmacy turning their prescription or getting a refill for their prescription, and they're charged $250 for a drug, or for all of their drugs for a month, they're told it's $1,500. And that ongoing problem of that low-income subsidy coding that is supposed to go from the federal government to the plans is an ongoing problem that we're not sure when CMS will be able to fix it. We're seeing some resolution, some better data than we had before, and the plans are telling us and the pharmacies are telling us that they have better data, but we continue to see this as an ongoing problem and will need help. Our clients need help every day resolving that problem. We also are starting to see the federal government, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, mandated a 90-day transition supply for individuals who were stable on a medication and were coming into the plan with those medications. And that ended March 31st. And already this week, we've seen about a huge increase. If you look at the charts that I gave you, you see a steady decline and then kind of a stabilization of the number of cases that were getting referred to the central office of the department, and we just saw a huge spike up this week. I don't have that data on there because it wasn't a full week, but we already had 100 calls yesterday from clients who were having trouble getting their medications that in January, February, March they were getting, and now they're not getting.
But, Madam, Mr. Chair?
Senator Winter.
Do you keep your data? You have the data based on cost of claims, but do you keep your data cost of the subject or the activity so that you can isolate where the problems are? You know, I have dollar amounts.
Chairman Richardson, Senator Winters, I'm not sure if I understood the question. We have the, I don't have it broken down by how much this is costing us for each individual problems. This is the LIS coding problem. This is the formulary control problems. This is enrollment problems. I don't have it broken down at that point yet. We're working on trying to develop a better system to be able to track that data.
Because if you're looking at system fixes, then you want to look at where systems problems are. That's the reason I asked that question, because you were talking about that there will be ongoing problems, and so it would be helpful to know where those systems problems actually are. And I just wondered if you collected your data that way so that it's kind of easier to tweak when you know what systems is.
Chairman Richardson, Senator Winters, we are in the process of, when we first developed our database to track our problems that our clients were having, it was more of a policy driver versus a problem resolution, and we created it within 5 days. So it's not as sophisticated as we want, and over time we're working on it to make it more sophisticated so that we can break down more information. And we are working with CMS to give them weekly data on here's the clients that are having the low-income subsidy problem, here's the clients that are having the enrollment problems, here's the formulary problems, and then we're also going to be able to break it down by specific prescription drug plans and particular pharmacies that are having problems so that we can all mobilize our resources around fixing those particular problems. So I think it's a good point, and I appreciate the encouragement to continue to drill down and get that data that we need.
Follow-up. Do you know what percentage of your 54,000 that you're having the problems with?
Chairman Richardson, Senator Winters, at this point we've had about 4,500 claims, actually 4,373 claims, or excuse me, cases or clients referred to central office. And really, unfortunately, our data only captures a client once. So we know that we have had clients have problems in January, February, March, and now April, and so they only show up once in our data. We also know that the local area agencies on aging, the developmental disability program offices, and the local DHS offices are also handling a tremendous number of cases. As we move further into implementation, more and more of the cases are being referred to central office for resolution because we're the ones that have the good contacts. So right now it's about, we can define that it's about 4,500 clients.
Mr. Chairman. Which is a good point, isn't it, that
yeah.
We're talking about less than 10% are having problems. That means 90% it's going well, but the focus is where there's the greatest need. Certainly, there was also a C-SPAN hearing that I was watching where they had people coming up and talking about how this had benefited them in so many different ways, and that gets very little publicity. So there's a lot that's good about it, but certainly we have to deal with where the problems
and,
are.
And hopefully over time, you know, the 90% becomes 95%, and that it isn't as though this is going to be a 10, 12% infinitum, hopefully.
Of course, also the issue is we're dealing with dual eligibles, right, which have a huge concern and a lot of focus, and there's a tremendous number of people who are just elderly who qualify for the program that need to be enrolled and are not yet enrolled, and the deadline is coming up. I think it's May 15th, and so there's much more that still needs to be done for the elderly that are not part of the system.
Chairman Richardson, it's a great point, because there are probably close to 50% of the people who are eligible for the Medicare prescription drug program who haven't made a decision yet. According to statistics and reports, some of those people have made a decision they're not going to participate, and others have just not been informed, don't know how to get through the process. And the SHIBA program, the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program that Rocky King supervises, is doing a phenomenal job, and so are many members of the legislature getting out there and having the town halls to educate people about the different choices and what they need to do before May 15th.
Thank you. Senator Gorley.
Yes, thank you. You said something rather quickly. I'm not quite sure that I'm understanding the point. You said that there were instances where people were getting their medication and now they aren't?
Chairman Richardson, Senator Gordley, that's correct. What happened was the federal government basically, they don't mandate to the plans, the prescription drug plans, but what they do is they provide guidance. And most of the prescription drug plans follow that guidance as if it was a mandate. And what the guidance said is that the prescription drug plans should provide a 90-day supply of medications for individuals who came into their plan stable on a current medical regime. So if you're taking glucophage for your diabetes, even if that's not on the plan's formulary, they were supposed to give you the glucophage. If you were taking a particular antipsychotic medication, they were supposed to keep you on that antipsychotic medication. For 90 days. The goal was is that that would give the plan time to notify the individual and hopefully that individual's physician to start a process either changing the person's prescriptions so that they would be on the formulary or getting an exception filed so that the person's drugs would be covered after that 90-day. What we found is that most people and most pharmacies were not told that the individual, that they were receiving this special transition benefit. What they were just going to the pharmacy, they would get their drug, and they'd go home. And since they weren't notified that they were getting this special benefit this month when the transition supply ended, they go into the pharmacy and they're said, oh, that's give me $150 because this isn't on your plan's formulary. And so we're working with that with the plans. We're working with physicians and other health care providers to actually get those exceptions in and hopefully get those drugs covered. If we can't get the drugs covered, then we're working with clients and the physician to get back in to talk together and get a new medication prescribed.
Thank you. I appreciate your help.
May I ask a follow-up to that? Again, it's just a clarity of this. On that piece then, if the client went in, you granted them the exception, the pharmacy didn't understand, is it your intent to have them switch plans or to have the plan approve that prescription within it?
Chairman Richardson, Representative Hanna, I think, it's not us, it's them.
Okay. So,
okay,
yeah.
Just...
I shouldn't point the finger.
Yeah, I try not to take any responsibility except for what I have actual authority to do. But what we were, as advocates for our clients, the first goal is to get the current plan to pay for their current the medications that the client needs. And then see if another drug would work, and then if a drug doesn't work, we then choice counsel that client again to find a prescription drug plan that will actually cover their medications. So it's actually a very intensive staff time involved in here, because we're doing the easy cases take about 45 minutes to resolve. The complicated cases can take weeks to resolve. And I think that that's something that the department's recognized, and we're going to keep our hotline staff. We have 4 Medicare hotline staff in central office. We're going to keep them through March. We're keeping our local office staff through August, and then we're hoping that over that time we can finish up the big problems, and then it's just new clients coming in, and when plans formularies changes or when a client gets new prescriptions, then we can work with those clients more closely.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
And this is
a comment. I mean, and maybe for Dr. Goldberg or all those who are working with clients to try to get this right. Yesterday, I was at the Coast Fork Nursing Facility in Cottage Grove having this conversation, and it doesn't matter where you go in any one of the care facilities, you're going to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And to be an expert in it, I think, is impossible. But it seems to me that what we've done is we've said to people, okay, pick a plan and sign up. And then they find out, oh, the plan I'm on doesn't cover one of the primary prescriptions that I need. And then when the pharmacy and the customer finally figure out, whoops, we're not matching up, rather than us, the state, the advocacy groups, having the ability to go back to CMS and say, look, it's silly, what seems like silliness to have that customer change plans rather than adjust the prescriptions allowable under the plan. I mean, we're asking people. I had a guy yesterday just go completely nuts on this, and his point is really good. It's like, why do I have to change plans completely when it's one prescription that we could just shift or, you know, adjust? And so if we can ask that question of CMS or the powers that be, I sure wish we could, because it makes a lot more sense to adjust the plan than it is to make somebody change plans.
Chairman Richardson and Representative Hanna, I totally agree with you, which is why we're putting a lot of advocacy efforts in making the plans pony up.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be providing good, comprehensive prescription drug coverage to these individuals. There are six classes of drugs that they're not supposed to discriminate against. They're not supposed to build their formulary in any way that discriminates against any population that's eligible for Medicare, and we want to hold their feet to the fire on that. And so we will do it both here locally at the state level, in Oregon, and then we will also be working with CMS to get CMS to move forward. And we've commented on all the regulation and the draft call for comments that CMS has put out for 07, because there will be changes, and we're hoping that after a year's worth of experience, CMS will strengthen some of that guidance to those plans.
How many plans are available?
I'm sorry?
How many plans are available in Oregon? I've forgotten the number.
40.
Chairman Richardson, there are 45 prescription drug plans approved through CMS. There are approximately another 30 Medicare Advantage plans that offer prescription drug coverage, and we don't know how many employer and union-sponsored plans are out there that are accepting the Medicare subsidy. We think it could be above 30 to 40 of those plans as well, which is why this is also very complicated and very individual. I could not tell a group of people. They always ask me, which plan should I be in? And I'm like, one, I'm not marketing for any plan, but two, more importantly, I cannot tell a group of people, because I need to talk to you, and I need to talk to you and you about which plan and what you already have and what drugs you take to be able to make that decision.
I'd like to just mention that, you know, when we went through this, we're still going through it with my mother-in-law. They've lost the paperwork, and so now we filed again yesterday. But we sat down at the computer, my wife and I, and took her drugs and then went through plan by plan and typed in those names to see which plan would give the best, because, you know, each company can decide what they want to cover and which phase they're going to put it in. And it just seems to me that with all the techies we have in this state, there should have been two of them that would sit down and put together all the drugs for the various companies, put together a whatever the term would be, where you could then type in the names of the drugs that you need. The computer then would analyze the various ability and then tell you, here are the three companies that would charge the least for this mix of drugs. I mean, that just seems like common sense, but there we go.
Chairman Richardson, your point is well taken, and that back in the fall with the new plan finder that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services put out, we were hoping that that's how it would work. And in some degree, it works that way. The formulary information has not been stable, and the cost has not been stable as they work out the kinks in that system. And I know what you mean. It's typing in all the drugs. It's actually one of the fun things I get to do on Friday nights before I take care of cases, and one of the finding plans that work for people on the 31st of the month so that we can get them enrolled before the first of the next day. And it can be very time consuming. We have some clients that are taking above 30 medications.
Mr. Chair, it's just a classic situation, and I don't know if you have ever seen the illustration where, you know, there was a desire for a backyard swing that only had the tire and a rope coming down, off the limb. And by the time we finished and got through with it, you didn't recognize either the limb, the tire, the string, you know, and the kid could not use it because, you know, it had come back tilted this way or cattywampus that way. And the concept was very good, but I don't think anyone talked to seniors, you know, me included. We did not grow up in a computer era, and yet the instructions is to go online to make your application. We didn't grow up with having stacks and volumes of information, and yet, in order to wade through it, you're going and looking like that. We're a very straightforward generation. We're not that comprehensive and convoluted. Jack came up with a word that was very in this generation. But anyway, so it wasn't designed to take us into consideration, nor all the variables that are involved in healthcare. And I think that that's probably the biggest. And ultimately, we will probably get there. But I think that maybe it would be wise to maybe have some focus groups of some of the actual users that will use this system and say, what would help you to get through it? And I really think the state has done a magnificent job. And anyone listening should know this is a federally designed program.
Thank you very much. There is one point that you bring up, and that is things change. For instance, I didn't realize until recently that the companies can change their formularies, and so you sign up for a plan, and then they may change where the drug fits in on it, and what was being charged when you signed up is no longer the way. And that was a variable that I just couldn't fathom. I thought that you at least have it for a year, or that there'd be some kind of commitment to it. So there are unexpected consequences, right?
Chairman Richardson, you're definitely right. They can change their coverage every 60 days. Now, we're not seeing a lot of movement on that except for some problems where what the federal government told the plans to cover were actually drugs that were precluded and they weren't allowed to cover, like there were a couple of benzodiazepines and barbiturates that they were told to cover, which they weren't supposed to. So those have gotten moved off. And there was a couple of other issues like that, FDA recalled a drug and those kinds of things. We haven't seen a lot of movement. I think over time we will see more movement as plans try to maximize the reimbursement that they're getting from the federal government.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll just take a final question from Senator Gardley.
Thank you very much. This part of the discussion is very interesting to me because it raises a concern about what has been the human impact of this major public policy change and implementation. Do we know, do we have a way of tracking where lives have been lost or lives altered because people couldn't get the medications that they depend on in a timely manner? Again, I'm just raising a concern about the human impact.
Chairman Richardson, Senator Gordley, it's one of my concerns as well as what's been the short-term impact on our clients and what's the long-term impact on it. I think that the chairman said that this is beneficial for many people. My aunt saved $800 in the first month of being enrolled in a prescription drug plan. One of my coworkers, her father-in-law, saved $500 in the first month. For the dual eligibles, it's been much more complicated, and we did have some clients run into health complications almost immediately in January. We know of four clients that actually were sent to the emergency room and two of them were hospitalized. But with the intervention of the governor to allow the state to actually start paying the claims on January 13th, we actually have had no crisis like that since then. And that's a critical point, is that we've had this safety net, this little window. The federal government, what we applied, I think the report talks about the Section 402 waiver. We have submitted the waiver. We're working with CMS to get reimbursed for the drug costs through March 8th, and then we'll be getting reimbursed for our admin costs through May 15th. We believe that intervention will go beyond that, but at least we'll be able to recoup some of the money that the state has laid out on behalf of our clients. But that leads me to another point about the ongoing co-payments for individuals who are full benefit dual eligibles. Many of these people receive approximately $500 a month, and they now have to come up with anywhere between one and $60 to $200 for their copayments. We have some clients who are taking 40 and 50 medications, and we're working with their physicians to see if there's something we can do, though I've learned very quickly that you can't tell doctors what to do. And so we're doing it very gently. The doctor, who's my boss right behind me, but we're gently working with the doctors to actually see if we can reduce the cost for those clients. But sometimes it's been many years of getting a client stable on current medications, and those ongoing copayments will continue to be a burden. And we're hearing from pharmacies and long-term care facilities that clients are starting to refuse their medications. And that's a big concern to us about the long-term effect that mandating copayments on our lowest-income individuals in our state will have on their health and the ability for us to care for them in an effective manner.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. There's so much more that we could say about this because it's such an important issue in so many lives. But we appreciate your report. Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Blake Johnson, Department of Administrative Services. We recommend you accept the report. And we note also that the department does anticipate some problems going forward, and they, in the next item, in the rebalance, they are requesting some general fund to continue some staffing to help in this area, and we support that request.
Thank you. We'll be seeing that. You've mentioned that the service will be able to be continued till August 31st. That depends on what happens in our next item, but we certainly hope that's going to take place. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We likewise recommend acknowledging receipt of the report, and we would point out that DHS has said that they're going to continue to report on this particular topic in the future.
Okay, thank you.
I move that we accept the acknowledge the receipt of the report.
Senator Winters moves that we acknowledge receipt of the report from DHS relating to Schedule D medical Medicaid supplement. Is there any comments or discussion? Is there any objection to acknowledging this report? Hearing none. It's done. And Senator Winters, would you go ahead and
thank you
tomorrow?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We now move into
14.
Oh, item. Oh, it is okay. We have item 14, maintenance of effort. We're now assisted by LFO analyst Sheila Baker, and we're ready to move forward. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director for Department of Human Services. I'd like to give kind of an overview of the report and then hopefully answer any questions about it. This is a report that was directed by you at the last e-board meeting to bring forward some detail on maintenance of effort issues. And there are three areas in particular within the department that have this maintenance of effort requirement: the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, the child care programs, and vocational rehabilitation programs. And they each have various forms of maintenance of effort, so I'll briefly describe what those forms are. And starting with Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, as some members of the panel will recall, 10 years ago in the Aid to Dependent Children program, the forerunner to TANF, there really wasn't a maintenance of effort issue. It was a matching funds program, so that on the administrative side, the state paid half the money and the feds paid half the money. And on the program side, the feds paid at whatever the Medicaid matching rate was, and state paid the balance for program benefits. In 1996, with the advent of federal welfare reform, the TANF program replaced Aid to Dependent Children and went from a matching program to a block grant program. And with that, our block grant from the federal government became $168 million per year. And in order to receive that block grant, Congress said, all right, the states have to continue to pay in some portion of what they had paid under the old program in terms of state funds so that they'd don't just replace all the state funds that were spent with federal funds, and that became the maintenance of effort level. The feds pegged our maintenance of effort level at our state expenditures in 1994 for the Aid to Dependent Children program, which is about $122 million in state funds that we were paying. And then as part of welfare reform, Congress said, okay, states will have to spend 75% of what they spent at their base year level if they meet participation requirements in the jobs program. And if they don't meet participation requirements in the jobs program, they'll have to spend 80% of what they spent in the base year. So that meant for Oregon, since we could meet our participation requirement in the jobs program, our required maintenance of effort level was 91.6 million, or 75% of what we had spent in 94. In subsequent years, as general fund became more and more scarce in these programs, we also looked to other agencies to provide sort of payments in lieu of our own maintenance of effort. Because in the TANF program, pieces would count as maintenance of effort if they generally met the requirements of the TANF program. So some expenditures in education or children and families or even child care tax credits that were refundable on the revenue side would count as maintenance of effort. So as general fund went down in the TANF program, we relied more and more on other expenditures to make that up. The penalties for not making our maintenance of effort in the TANF program are particularly severe. And just as an example, if we are $6.1 million under for two consecutive years in terms of our maintenance of effort, that equates to about a $25 million penalty, all things combined. And I pick 6.1 million because that's the difference between our 75% rate and our 80% rate. If we are unable to maintain our participation, it's another 6.1 million in state funds that would be required in the program. I think maintenance of effort in TANF probably poses the largest set of challenges for us, in particular in the last several biennia, because we have not had enough general fund in the TANF program to meet that on a state fiscal year basis. So by the time we got to the end of the state fiscal year, we hadn't met our maintenance of effort requirement because we have an additional quarter, which is the last quarter of the federal fiscal year. We essentially have backloaded additional general fund expenditures in the TANF program to make that federal fiscal year amount up. And I think that does two things. It literally every year then pushes forward the problem because we've already expended some of the general fund in what was now the previous state fiscal year. And I think we are approaching the point at which we will reach our limit on our ability to do that, how much we spend in TANF in that last quarter in terms of being able to make up the maintenance of effort amount. So there's that issue. There's a participation rate issue because the TANF program was just reauthorized as part of the Deficit Reduction Act. There are significant changes for Oregon and for nationally in terms of participation rate requirements, including for two-parent programs, maintaining participation at the 90% rate. I anticipate that few, if any, states will be able to get to the 90% participation rate for two-parent families. It will be a challenge for us to get to the participation rate for all families, but what that is likely to do is increase our maintenance of effort requirement, again, from the 75% to the 80% level. So that would require another $6 million in maintenance of effort costs to the state. And finally, the federal government is increasingly looking at other maintenance of effort pieces that come in from outside of the TANF programs. This is something that the General Accounting Office visited us and other states recently to take a look at. So we are continuing to improve our, I think, both our record-keeping and scrutiny at all the funds that we use for maintenance of effort to make sure that they're solid. On the Child Care and Development Fund, and that fund provides the bulk of the funding for the employment-related daycare program, child care resource and referral network, and some capacity building activities of the Oregon Commission for Children and Families. That maintenance of effort rate is, again, a different concept from what we have in TANF. That was set at the 1995 level.
The history is really interesting, but would you focus on where we stand in this biennium as far as meeting our maintenance of effort requirements?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to do that. We are meeting our maintenance of effort requirement in this biennium. Again, it is getting challenging for us to do that because of revenue reductions, but okay. we are currently meeting maintenance of effort both in TANF, child care, and vocational rehabilitation.
All right, and you were saying or alluding to certain things that could interfere with that by the end of the biennium, unknowns or things that we can't control, one of which would be the Deficit Reduction Act changes, which we don't know what the final effect will be. Also, I understand that there's a lawsuit that could affect the availability of funds under the Tobacco Master Settlement, that if that if there was to be a reduction in Tobacco Master Settlement money, I assume that that would be felt by DHS. Is that correct?
It would likely be felt by DHS. I don't know that that would be a maintenance of effort issue on the TANF program, though.
It wouldn't affect it. Okay, are there other areas that we as a committee need to be just concerned about, just to make sure, to assure that we can meet the maintenance of effort requirements throughout this biennium?
Mr. Chair, I think as we get into the final rebalancing and the building of the next biennium's budget is where I think the most of the caveats will be known, and I think where the challenges will be.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could make a comment about the Master Settlement Agreement money, that potential loss of revenue would not directly affect the maintenance of effort requirements in these programs. However, it does affect the bigger picture, which is why the agencies were asked to report on these, is that as you're looking at potential general fund reductions that might backfill that revenue, potential general fund reductions elsewhere in the department that might backfill that revenue that now is going to the health plan, or any other actions that would affect general fund expenditures, then the maintenance of effort requirements come into play and become a consideration as you're looking at those potential actions.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Teschner?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Pam Teschner with the Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Okay, thank you. Speaker.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, we also recommend you acknowledge receipt of the report. I would note that you will, as we talk about the rebalance this time and throughout the biennium, these issues will recur and there will be ongoing discussions about them.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hannah.
Mr. Chair, I'd recommend the committee acknowledge receipt of the status report on maintenance of effort for temporary assistance to needy families, child care development, and vocational rehab.
Representative Hannah has made the motion that we acknowledge the receipt of this report. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, then we acknowledge receipt. Thank you very much. Carrier, Representative Hannah. All right, we're up to item 13, Department of Human Services report on rebalance issues.
Going backwards.
Well, he's going to move. You're
going backwards, Mr. Chair.
You remember?
Oh.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. What we're going to do this morning is I follow the same path we followed at the last e-board, which is at that time I had talked through some of our sort of management and administrative plans, and what I'd like to do is update the committee about our progress and what we've done to date in that regard, and then following my presentation, we can get through the rebalance items in terms of the dollars and cents, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Great. Okay. With that said, you have some notes in front of you that I'll be talking from. When we last spoke in January, came before you to indicate that we were projecting a $172 million shortfall. I'm here today to say that we are looking at a projected $140.2 million shortfall, and then with the $4 million of administrative reductions that we had spoken about taking at the last emergency board, we're at $136.2 million as a projected shortfall. And we'll go through each of the items to give you a sense of why that is and what the changes have been. Let me just summarize it at a high level to let you know that the reason that number has gone down has really been a combination of three things. There's been a moderation in our caseload growth, and that's been the largest contributor to this, that when we recently have completed a spring forecast, and when we compare that to the fall forecast, although the caseloads are still higher than they were from the spring 2005 forecast, the forecast upon which the initial budget was built, they are moderating a little bit in a couple of areas, particularly in the Oregon Health Plan and the Aged, Blind, and Disabled group. We're just ever so slightly lower in our caseload numbers in a projection, as well as in the TANF group. There are some other groups that the projections are higher, but when we put that all together, we're seeing approximately $22 million less of a projected need than we had anticipated previously. While we're talking about projections, the Department of Revenue is projecting that we will see some increase in tobacco tax dollars. And the last issue that's helping bring that number down, and the last issue is the Medicare clawback. You just heard a presentation about issues around the Medicare program. The federal government sent every state a new bill for the clawback last month, and every state will owe the federal government a little bit less. And so we owe a little bit less than our previous bill from the federal government was, and that's helping to take that number down to where we are today. And as we talked last time, although we're at a projected shortfall of 136.2 today, that number will change. And that number will change because there are a number of future variables, some of which we can hopefully plan for and others that we can't. There are a number of environmental factors that happens in our communities. You heard about one today, which is what's happening in the Medicare prescription drug program, which we had we had thought would actually be more of a money saver, and we've found that there have been a lot of problems and a need to address that and concerns in that regard. There also is on the horizon the potential of federal changes, and I've spoken to a number of legislators about this, but let me talk for a moment about what may or may not be in the future. There's really two issues. One is the Deficit Reduction Act. The Deficit Reduction Act was passed by Congress in February, and it's a five-year bill that really outlines a number of monetary savings on the federal side over the next 5 years. And there are provisions in that bill that will affect us in the next biennium, and there are provisions in that bill that will affect us this biennium. Let me just focus for today, because I think the important issue for us today is on the changes that could potentially affect us this biennium. And there are two provisions in the bill that may affect us, and I use the word may because this bill was passed in February. These changes, some of them are retroactive to January 2006. The rules have not been written, and we really do not know what is in store. It puts us in a very difficult position as a state, and I'll talk about that a little more in a moment. But the targeted case management changes are changes to the way that the federal government's participation in the case management expenses that we have, particularly around child welfare, the funds that we use to help provide children with access to care, with helping get parents and children the services that they need. The federal government is changing the rules about what constitutes case management, and they're moving from what has been a social model around case management to a very strict medical interpretation of what case management is. The other issue is changes in the TANF program, in particular changes to our caseload reduction credit. And I wish I could be more specific. The issue, as I indicated, is that the rules have not been written about any of this. And we have been working very closely with our congressional delegation. The governor and I went to Washington, D.C. to meet with the delegation and run through these issues with them. They're well aware. We're in frequent contact. And the issue for us as a state is simply this, that we passed a balanced budget 6 months ago based on a set of assumptions that we've been working on with the federal government. You know, suddenly these assumptions have changed midstream. And the issue that we've been making, and we actually had an opportunity to meet with Secretary Leavitt last week and said the same thing, and as a former governor, he understands, is that while we can recognize changes in federal policy, what we're asking for as a state is an opportunity to put those off to a place that we can prepare for those in our next budget and make the kinds of policy and financial decisions that we as a state need to make. Having said that, we really don't know what kind of flexibility we will have to do that. Our delegation is helping us. The National Governors Association unanimously signed on to a letter to CMS about the TANF changes, because this is certainly an issue for every state. And we just don't know what flexibility we will or won't have. We're pushing for the maximum amount of flexibility.
Without it, it's going to cost us money.
Yes.
I know that I was reading that one of the requirements was that TANF, and I guess recipients would be working at a 50% level. I think that's what it was, that there had to be employment percentage of 50% or else you'd lose the benefit. And there was only three states that were at the 50% level, and that Oregon was like at 16%. So we had a major way
yes.
to go.
And
so we would be in default in a number of areas, I think.
Yes. Chair Richardson, you're correct. The larger financial issue would actually be in targeted case management, where depending on how those rules are written and what is included or not included as targeted case management, and when that either starts or doesn't start, whether it started in January and they just haven't told us, or it will start when the rules are complete, we estimate that between the TANF and the targeted case management, this could be anywhere from zero to $40 to $50 million for the rest of the biennium.
Mr. Chair,
Senator.
Dr. Goldberg, any indication from the feds as to when they're going to start working on the regulations? Are they giving any kind of deadlines or targeted deadlines?
Senator Winters, Chair Richardson, we don't have any firm information. And we don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing. In terms of, I mean, I think the issue that we would like is firm information that is beneficial to us, to get some information that's firm tomorrow that tells us here's the changes and here's what you owe. So that's what we really don't know. And as I had indicated, we've been working very, very closely with our delegation and using every opportunity we have to speak to Secretary Leavitt and others to, I think, just have them understand our need for flexibility in this.
Thank you.
The other issue, so one is the Deficit Reduction Act. The other issue, which is even less certain, is the federal fiscal year 2007 budget. And the reason I say it's less certain is it hasn't passed yet. So we don't know what's in it, but we do know that some of the proposals from the president for that, and there's one in particular which would be a concern for us, which is a reduction in the ceiling in provider taxes from 6% to 3%. And that would affect our OHP standard program, as well as our the nursing facility tax that we have as well. Whether that will become a reality, I don't know. I will say on the optimistic side that there was an attempt to have this in the Deficit Reduction Act, and it didn't get through Congress, but I just think it's important for us to be aware that there are a number of changes that loom ahead, and I will do my best to keep everybody informed as to what those are and when we actually have some real information that we can share. The next issue are the issues that are under our control. There's a number of issues that we can control ourselves, and that's what I'd like to talk to you about today, which are the actions that we're taking to improve our transparency, our fiscal accountability, and our effectiveness and efficiency as an agency. When I was here in January, I outlined a number of steps that were in the planning, and what I'd like to do is report to you today on the progress and where we are. The first is I had spoken about our need to improve our tracking of expenditures and revenues. And what we have done in that regard are several things. In November, I had asked the state controller to come into the organization and help us look at our fiscal accountability. That has been done in a very comprehensive fashion. The state controller has put together an executive team with himself, Clyde Psyche, Deputy Director of DHS, and Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the State Treasury. They've formed a sort of an executive team to oversee this process. There are five working groups looking at five different aspects of the agency: budgeting, accounting, internal controls, cash receiving, and banking, and I believe the fifth is payment and recovery. But they're looking at the five key financial functions that we have. They've been working in the agency since December. They have visited three other states known for their human services financial management: Arizona, Washington, and Michigan. They have put together a comprehensive review, which I just received last week, and we are beginning to, each of those groups have put together a review with a set of findings followed by a set of recommendations. What we've now done is assembled what are recommendations from across the agency, and from all these functions and are assembling this into one single comprehensive work plan. We began that work yesterday with representatives from LFO who were involved in the process. John Britton and Sheila were there. Representatives from Budget and Management, Representative Richardson and Morgan were there. And we began to take these recommendations and now, in essence, stage them in a thoughtful and mindful manner in terms of what do we need to do first in the next 3 months? What do we need to do in the next year? And what do we need to look at in the next biennium? And we're looking at these in several ways. You know, one is what needs to be done in terms of organizational structure? What are the structural changes we need to have? Secondly, from a personnel perspective, who are the when we have a structure, then what are the skills and what are the people that you need to do those jobs? And then lastly, what are the systems that we need to accomplish that? And we're beginning to work through that. I've been taught by my lawyer friends to never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. So I was going to ask Representative Richardson what he thought of the process, but since I don't know what he will say, I'll just give you a quote from my guess is that he would have a similar sense that I had, which is a quote from Peter Drucker, which I'll probably get wrong, but it says something to the effect of, you know, plans are only good when they degenerate into hard work. And I think we're degenerating into the hard work. Representative Richardson, what do you think?
I'm not normally questioned from those on the other side of the dais.
Okay, I take that back.
I'm happy to do that at this point and just let you know and let the committee know that I am pleased and encouraged that those that were in the meeting yesterday were focused on where we're at, where could we go, and how can we get there. Not it's more of a yes, we could do this if kind of meeting, and instead of the more standard no, we can't make any kind of change because it's not the way we've been doing it, and all these other things. And so it was there was an attitude of progress and cooperation from many different agencies, and you have some key people there. So I'm encouraged. I understand also that the Senate will be naming a couple of senators to also participate in that meeting in the future. I think it's important that the legislature be a part of those meetings so that when it comes down to final decision time that we can have everybody having been at the table so there's no surprises.
Hi.
Any other questions?
No. I think I've had my one, and I understand the rules. I knew I was just getting one question. I might have asked a different one, but I feel that we're making substantive progress, and as Representative Richardson indicated, you know, from my standpoint, what helps us as an agency is the involvement and assistance from everybody, that this is not something that we can do alone, that there are issues that require the help of experts within the state, going to require the help of experts outside of the state that are going to necessitate eventually perhaps some policy and legislative changes to address certain issues around you know, cash flow and banking, and we are all in this together and look forward to working through that. As we work through that, have made a number of other steps towards improving our fiscal accountability. I believe mentioned that hired Jim Scherzinger to help as an expert in budget and financial management. He's now working in the agency and helping to manage this process and help us move forward. I am actively recruiting for a chief financial officer as an individual who in an organization our size can provide the expertise and management and big picture view and accountability for our fiscal and financial operations. And lastly, have put together a group of outside experts, four individuals from the private sector who have a wealth of experience in organizational management and fiscal management, who are going to serve as an advisory group to myself and Jim Scherzinger and who's ever the eventual CFO to help us, I think, what provide the kind of advice and guidance and to allow me the opportunity to have them help provide some input into where we're going around this review team. So that's where we are in terms of our fiscal accountability. The next piece is caseload forecasting and monitoring. When we spoke in January, clearly one of the issues that contributed to our, the largest issue that contributed to our $172 million shortfall was the fact that our caseloads were much higher than were anticipated in the spring 2005 forecast. We've made a number of steps to improve the reliability and validity of our forecasting. We now have the Department of Administrative Services, the folks who do the economic forecasting and prison forecasting, serving as an external review of our forecasts. We met with DAS and had talked with them about actually having them do the forecasting, moving that function outside of the agency. We talked through that. We were concerned that given the numbers of programs that we forecast for and the complexity of the rules, federal policy changes, as I've indicated today, that there was a concern that moving the forecasters too far from the kind of programmatic issues might be problematic. And I think we've come up with a good hybrid, which is the fact that the Department of Administrative Services will provide an external review and, in essence, a check on the validity and reliability of our forecasts. And we've also involved that group as well as representatives from LFO and others into a group to help us not just check the end result, but to work with us on some of the methodologic issues. And there's a group that met, has been discussing changes that we could make in the future to the processes and methods we do around forecasting. Lastly, we have a... Yes?
Chris and Hannah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Goldberg, I know we've touched on this subject before, and I'm pleased the work that we're doing on the caseload work and the forecasting piece, and I applaud the folks that are currently participating in that work group to review the caseload and so forth. But again, like at our last Oregon Health Plan Task Force meeting, we heard from providers. And providers, in many cases, have more current data than the state has when it comes to caseload. And still we haven't added a provider to this group, or maybe we're going to get there, but those providers can give us current data. And many times what I've seen in my legislative experience, which is pretty short, but we keep looking at data and we talk about what happened in 04 and maybe we talk about what happened in 05. Lots of these providers told us and showed us their ability to give us data. Hey, they can tell you who they served yesterday. So I want to get my point out there again. Let's include them and get them in the picture.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, we are working on that. The issue and what we've been discussing is the right place to get that input. And we sat down as a group to talk about not if we're going to include a group like that, but how.
Okay.
So we've had that discussion. You've had some diagrams on the forecasting process, and there are a number of groups that provide advice and technical assistance. And the question was, at which point is it appropriate to have that input? Because I totally agree with you. I think having been one of those providers and understanding, I think that there are people who see things before we do, mm-hmm. and we need to include them and involve them. What we've discussed this as a management team in the agency. I've asked each of the programs to provide an appropriate representative for a group so we can look at, you know, whether it's emergency room docs or people that run our health plans or nursing homes. We're trying to come up with the right, who are the right 8 to 10 people, and then we're going to involve them as a group in this process.
Correct.
They might also be good as an additional external review because, you know, you do your forecasting, and they may be able to actually come up with more focused opinions on it and suggestions than DAS could do, since DAS is one step away from where DHS is. DAS can say, this looked like you followed the right procedures or protocols, but it doesn't have anything to do with the outcome and whether or not it's going to be valid. And one other thing I want to mention is I noticed, and I was very pleased, that with the operations review team, that they spent the time to go to these three other states to see how they were doing it. And I've mentioned before, and I still would hope that I could get a response as to whether or not other states have been looked at to see how they do their forecasting and whether or not they have such wide swings that we have, because, you know, maybe it's the nature of the beast and maybe it's not, but if there's things that we can learn from other procedures being done by other states who have the same kind of concerns we do, it would be valuable. Do you know if that's taking place?
George, I know that Judy Moore Peterson has looked at some of the other some data from some other states and some things, and we can certainly get you some information.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gorley.
Thank you. Again, with an eye toward that external review, is there a place for university involvement in this regard?
Senator Gordley, Chair Richardson, I believe that there are some folks from academic programs in one of the groups. We external input and work groups are us, and I think it's really important. I don't say that lightly. And I know that we have some individuals involved in the forecasting process. Mm-hmm. From I just can't tell you exactly what group and who, but I can get you that info.
Yeah, PSU and U of O come to mind, but thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking of work groups, I had indicated that we would put together a caseload work group, and this is a group of four legislators, Representatives Richardson and Avakian, Senator Winters, and Senator Mona Sanderson, along with a representative from the Speaker and the President's Office, from LFO and BAM, to meet on a monthly basis, which we've been doing. We met in February 7th, and we met on March 15th. And what that group is doing is looking at the forecasts, and then every month we get together, we look at the actuals as they come in. And what we are doing as a group is getting comfortable and understanding whether our caseload actuals are tracking with our forecasts or not, and some of the dynamics that are happening. I think that this is providing a number of things. I think, one, it's allowing all of us a greater understanding of what's happening month by month so that we can have some comfort in the direction these numbers are going in, that we don't have surprises every 6 months, and that we can begin as an agency to also understand when there are variations from forecasts in terms of actuals, to try and understand why or why not, and improve what we're doing. So we have that going, and we will continue to meet every 4 to 6 weeks.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Winter.
Just a question. One of the questions that was raised at our last meeting was the honing down to be able to provide the caseload information by the region or the branch, and whether or not we've gotten there, because if you're going to look at deployment of resources, one needs to know whether there's changes with the various regions. And so where are we with that kind of...
Senator Winters, Chair Richardson, I don't know. But I do recall that that was raised at the meeting on March 15th, and I don't know, and I'll find out for you.
Because it seems to me in doing forecasting that if you know the trend lines that are changing, both from population demographics, people moving in, moving out, aging, and all of these issues, you have a better way of talking about how you're going to deploy resources or the guesstimates of what's going to happen in those various regional areas and, you know, those communities, both with TANF as well as the Oregon Health Plan.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, we're trying to continue to improve the way we do this. I think right now our focus is on can we get the larger picture, but certainly, I mean, that's an important issue when I reflect on the fact of, you know, what's potentially happening in some of our coastal communities with, you know, changes in what's happening in the fishing industry. That's going to have an impact on what we do. That's another one of those external factors, and we need to understand that.
My question is, methodology, don't you collect from the smaller communities and then it goes to the larger universe? I guess I'm just...
In other words, if you have the data, can you break it out by region?
And that's what I don't know.
Okay.
Vic, do you know?
Representative Richland, Senator Winters, Vic Todd, Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. The issue that we have is, you're correct, that the data does come through the systems and we can identify the people locally. The issue that you get into is the ability to forecast at that, you know, at a lower level. It just adds need for additional resource, additional analysis. And I think, as Bruce is saying, at this point we are really focused on the statewide estimation process. But it's very valid in terms of an approach.
Thank you.
We'll have a further conversation, because for planning purposes, even if you start moving towards planning, you need to know what area of the state, for example, if you're going into one stops, have the greatest need versus another area of the state. So it would just seem to me that somehow we need to make certain that we can collect that data by region.
I agree.
Okay, if we could...
Okay. Lastly, when I spoke at the last meeting, talked about, you know, efforts we were making, and I think it segues nicely on Senator Winter's comment about areas and what we're doing around the state was focusing on eligibility and being certain that we're making movements to assure consistency and fairness in how we determine eligibility across the state. And, you know, in interest of time, we've made a number of steps moving forward to improve the consistency of that eligibility by looking at setting up some ways where we've looking at pulling samples of cases, examining them, and looking at trends across the state in terms of regional trends, what's happening, so that we can ensure some of that consistency. And we're doing that both in our OHP, TANF, as well as in our senior programs. And happy at any point to talk about that in more detail, but we're moving that forward. Lastly, in terms of related activities, as I indicated, we are moving forward with $4 million in administrative savings, working closely with our delegation around the federal changes. We are, you know, working with our external stakeholders and others to look at ways we can identify efficiencies in what we do, and continuing to report back to you on a regular basis on our progress and how we're doing.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corley.
Thank you. I would like to go back to the eligibility page 7. Could you talk to us about the training piece that you indicated here? What are the challenges around training? Do you have capacity? Do you have the right people? What are the resource challenges? Resource meaning dollars?
I Senator Gordley and Chair Richardson, right now our challenges are more in terms of seeking a consistency across the state, that we are looking at how we can train people. We do need more research. If we are going to look at, for instance, further case review, certainly one of our challenges has been we can only review a certain number of cases, and if we don't have additional staff, we can't do any additional efforts. We had made some tremendous strides in reducing our error rate in food stamps from a 13% error rate down to, I believe, is a 6% error rate over the last year and a half. And that's been a great effort, and we looked at taking that same effort and using that same process in some of our other programs. And what staff indicated was we don't have the resources to do it at the same scale, and that we would need some additional resources. And what we're trying to do is to emulate the same effort as a in a lighter manner, with less review, less samples, those types of issues. Clearly, the more resource we put into these kinds of efforts, the greater the effect, and that's where we are.
Right.
That
do this portion of the presentation before we start looking at some of the numbers that are being included. If not, then we'd like to have you not hit every line, but hit the high points and things that we need to focus on. Okay. Moving to the other handout.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, again, I'm Vic Todd, Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. What I've given you is a display that is labeled the major issues, so I will attempt to pare that down a little even. But we did review this somewhat in January, and a lot of this is an update of previous issues. The first page is a lot of which Bruce has already talked about in terms of the major categories, and I won't spend any time there.
I'd have a question on the first page. On line two, number two, it says change in federal Medicaid match rate, and then as I was looking over the materials, I see that that's a consistent amount in each of the columns, even though we've had a substantial reduction in caseload in some, you know, such as TANF cases. And so it seems to me that if it's connected to the caseload and the caseload's gone down, then that hole should go down as well.
Chair Richardson, the way that we treat that FMAP, federal match rate change, is from a base level. And then we adjust for any caseload changes based upon the new match rate.
Okay.
So that's why it stays at, it's a fixed level. It doesn't change as the forecast changes, because it's based on, it's taking what was in the base, making that correction, and then when you deal with the future changes, you make those adjustments.
So the base did not take in consideration the forecast increase in cases in TANF that came from the fall forecast or the spring forecast of last year, and compare it to the lesser caseload in the current? I'm just trying to see if we have accurate information.
I shouldn't say base. It's alleged adopted budget is what we're modifying. Is what were the assumptions in the alleged adopted budget with respect to federal match rate?
Okay, but the whole reason that we have the hole is because we've had changes in the amounts of money that will be incurred, or expenses incurred, because of increased caseload. And so are you saying that when we had the $172 million hole, it did not include any additional costs above the base based on the legislative approved budget for the additional cases and that loss of that 0.5% of federal match?
Chair Richardson, what I'm saying is that the adjustment that we made was first to deal with the federal match rate change impact on the budget before the new forecast. Then when you price the new forecast, you actually use the new federal match rate. So there's no additional adjustment to make.
Okay. All right.
Adjusted in the base,
You put it as a
included.
As one of the considerations before you do your math.
It's included in the projected additional need because of additional caseload.
Okay.
That the other piece is static. It remains static.
All right. Thank you. Are there any other questions? As you've reviewed these materials that we had, this is kind of an update of what we've been given. Go ahead.
Okay. On page 2 of this is the children's, adults, and families. And the first two items, the first item is related to the federal match rate change. And the second item is the roll-up costs of the 0305 issues that we had identified. And these are the issues we had brought forward in January. Item number 3 is reflecting a lower estimate of the TANF, ERDC, and the domestic violence programs. Those lower caseloads are offset by slightly higher cost per case in those programs. The costs here are being covered by additional TANF federal funds that we had available, so we didn't need to add any general fund into this issue. Item 4 is related to the food stamp caseload, and we adjusted the non-limited funding administratively and during the month of March. So it's just reflecting that to show you that we've increased that non-limited limitation.
Before you leave food stamps, in the other materials, it talks about a $400,000 cost because we did have a high error rate. And that it says that it could have been $800,000, but that it's only going to be $400,000 because the air rate's been brought down, and we congratulate you on being able to bring the air rate down. My question is that $400,000, where does that go? Do you know what I'm referring to?
I think you're referring to item number 8 on page 3.
Oh, okay.
Basically, Chair Richardson, it goes towards reinvestment, and probably someone from CAP could explain it in terms of exactly where they are directing that.
Okay, it gets utilized in our plans. It doesn't go to the federal government or anything like that.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Item 5, the child welfare substitute program costs are higher, although this estimate is actually lower than the prior estimate, so the amount there has gone down. Item number 7, is reflecting the staffing changes for the various programs within CAF. What we would note here is that while we're not requesting positions related to the medical caseloads, we are requesting positions related to the substitute care program growth in child welfare. And so we've requested 63 positions in this request. Item number 11 is an expansion that's of the overpayment recovery unit that we would add 3 positions in the administrative services cluster, and would expect that to that's the cost for those positions is about $100,000 general fund or other funds. Excuse me, we're funding those with the recoveries that we're anticipating, and that would offset within CAF a little over $200,000 of general fund need. Within the seniors program, starting on page 4, items 1 and 2 are, I won't stop there because we've talked about those generally. Item number 3 is a higher estimate related to the DD caseloads, both for adults and children. During the latter part of the 0305 biennium, they saw a significant increase in those populations, and this is adjusting for that actuality.
Mr. Chair?
Item number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general comment, because both in the letter discussing the rebalance and in this information, I think that's a total fund difference, almost $25 million. And to use the term significant increase in caseload, I'd sure prefer to see the number, because I like to put it on a per case basis.
Sure.
And significant to me and $25 million kind of go hand in hand. And both the letter and this information describe it that way. And it doesn't really tell us very much, except it's a lot of money.
That's something perhaps we should do with all of this, because I think we can't ever forget that this isn't a budget exercise. This is about individuals. And I think that the more we talk about this in terms of dollars and use words like significant, we lose sight of the fact that these issues are very significant to everybody, and we it would be a good thing for us to do, and I think we'll try and do that. Thank you.
Dr. Goldberg, I appreciate that, because it's a reoccurring theme in the entire document.
No.
And I appreciate your comment, because my notes as I go through the letter would repeat this question over and over and over. What's the percentage of increase, and what's the net number in terms of cases or caseload? So we can solve that problem now, but I do want to note it's a reoccurring theme.
We appreciate the details.
Yeah, no, this is what we're going to make it better for all of us.
Item number four is referring to the nursing facility caseloads, and that estimate overall is higher by about 200 cases, and the cost per case is also higher. And what we can do is we can provide you a table of all of these, Representative Hanna, that kind of gives you the breakdown for all these caseload changes and the cost per person.
Thank you.
If you would broadcast that to the committee, we'd appreciate that. Those that want it can read it.
Of course.
Thank you.
Item number five is related to the home care workers, in-home home care worker program. This program has, we're estimating overall lower cost for this program about $11.7 million. However, as part of the negotiated contracts process, there was a provision for or anticipated an additional $10 million cost related to that. We've reestimated that to be about $8.8 million, and so that nets against that savings. The legislature had set aside a special purpose appropriation of $10 million for that those provisions, and we're not going to request those. We don't believe at this point we need them. Item number nine is related to the Medicare Modernization Act, and Jane Allen mentioned this earlier, that we're requesting to extend these limited duration positions to continue to deal with the workload. So I just wanted to point that out to you. Item number 11 is another expansion of a recovery unit. This is the Estates Recovery Unit. Again, the positions, three positions, are in the administrative services cluster. Again, costing about $100,000 other funds, and are anticipating to generate about $500,000 in other fund revenue within the SPD cluster. Now on page 7, within health services, again, the first two items are similar to what we've talked about before. Item number 3 is the overall caseload re-estimation impact. It's lower by about $23 million. Um, item number 4 on page 8 reflects the increased tobacco tax revenue that's forecast by the Department of Revenue, and also includes, well, actually includes a couple items which I think I failed to number.
Take you back just for a moment.
Sure.
Back to the bottom paragraph of number 3 on page 7. It talks about citizen alien waived emergent medical. I was looking at the numbers, and we have a projection of population that it's continuing to go down, and yet the cost is going up, so we have less people, but the overall cost for the whole program is going up, which is a fairly substantial disparity. Can you explain why we have that?
Representative Richardson, the primary driver there is the continued high number of births that are paid for in this program. And so while the overall population is going down, the number of deliveries we're paying for is holding.
Okay, and so this was not anticipated a year ago, that they would cost this much or that we'd have this many births? Is that what we're talking about?
I think what wasn't, and Chair Richardson, I think what wasn't anticipated is what's really known as case mix in terms of the numbers and types of cases that come into this program and the cost per case. It's less people, but the cost per case has increased, and that's what's driven this, and I believe it's because of what has been a change in that case mix, and we can have someone from the program talk in more detail.
Mr. Chair, it may be helpful and clarification if when this kind of reporting comes about, if you're saying that the cases are going up, down, but the costs are going up, that you actually give us, we're dealing with X number of cases versus whatever, because it provides for some clarity. It would also provide some clarity if it's related to childbirth, whether we're seeing more difficult cases. I mean, I think that what we're asking is just for some clarity in those categories.
And more now.
$1 billion increase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, could you provide that for us?
Yeah.
Thank you.
We'll give you a breakdown and an analysis of where, why, and what's happened.
Thank you. Mr. Khan?
Yes, I think I'll just go down to the bottom of page 8, which is the Medicare modernization impact clawback issue that Bruce had mentioned earlier in terms of the savings associated with that. And the last item on page 9 is related to adjusting the MCO admin cost amount based upon our actuaries' recommendations. Item 8 is related to fee-for-service for physicians, 1% increase there in terms of anticipated costs. And item 10 is related to the federally qualified health centers costs that as we see more of these come online, it adds additional costs for the department.
Mr. Chair, a moment. Representative Hanna.
Two comments, and I know you guys are working incredibly hard and on all this material, and I hope we're working equally as hard. This is just a general comment, and then I'll get detailed. But I don't know the timing of the letter document to the spreadsheet piece. And whether or not, but we get this first, or I got this piece first, so you study through this, you make all your notes on it, but there's no reference to where it is in this piece. If we could footnote that stuff together, it'd make it a lot easier, because I'm up here tearing through the letter to keep up with where we are in the spreadsheet piece, and it'd make it a little easier if we work from this first, and we get it first, and we could reference back. That's just a point. So now I have a question to the health clinic piece. And again, I'm referring to my letter piece because that's what I had first. But and maybe Mr. Britton, you can talk to this. These additional costs are from higher reimbursements, as
as I understand that. And then it goes on to the bottom of the paragraph about the Multnomah County billing practice results in $9.1 million in general fund increase. And so my note is, does that apply to FQHC costs, or is that really a float issue? Is it a banking float issue based on the timing of the billing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hannon, of the 975, $9.1 million is associated with Multnomah County particularly. They operate some FQHCs, and it is a float issue. Exactly correct.
Okay.
The remaining amount, the $600,000, which was in the January report, relates to the additional FQHCs.
To the
and the wraparound payment that we make to them.
Follow-up? So to the three that are mentioned in the Benton Lane and Benton and Lane counties and the Medford facility,
and I believe also OHSU.
Well, see, and again, this goes to a question. I mean, it says it's anticipated. So, are we funding for the anticipated opening? I mean, are we sort of pre-funding for the anticipated opening of the FQHC at OHSU?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, this is in anticipation of the costs that will incur in this biennium for those facilities.
Okay. So, again, follow-up. So we think it's going to open. We took a look at the forecast for the kind of work they might do and said, we know it's coming. Let's take a good shot at it.
Well, Representative Hannah, my understanding is that the clinic actually is open. And that this is there's a lag in the billing, and that's exactly what this does. Is it doesn't anticipate that it will open. It is open. It's an anticipated of the expense that will follow as a result of that.
Follow up. That's the 9.1. That's the 9.1 in terms of that float piece.
OHSU.
No.
Representative Hannah, the $9 million is Multnomah County, not OHSU.
Okay. All right. That helps.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. I wonder if Mr. Britton could take us through the discussion that starts at the bottom of page
13.
7, yes. And carries over to 13.8. It's a discussion related to federally qualified FQHCs and rural health clinics. And a question is posed in this discussion. The question is, do FQHCs and RHCs provide better services, superior outcomes, or reduced expenditures? Again, if you could put the question in context, and then I'd like to come back with a follow-up after we hear the presentation.
So, Mr. Chair, put
us all in the right place. I'm sorry, Senator Gordley.
Oh.
13,
we're at the bottom. We're in the LFO
okay.
analysis.
Oh, here, 13.8-8.
Bottom of 13.7, top of 13.8. Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, whenever I am seeing some increased costs, and in this particular instance, these relate to the federally qualified health clinics and some new rural health clinics as well, my question, because they are reimbursed at an enhanced rate compared to other primary care providers, is the necessity of that increased cost. Now, we're required under federal law to provide a wraparound payment, apparently not to 100% of their costs. That is apparently not the case, but it is an enhanced reimbursement compared to other primary care providers. Under state law, we have to pay rural health clinics that in this case are associated with type A and type B hospitals 100% of their costs. My question is simply to raise an issue, not to be critical necessarily, mm-hmm. but to raise the issue of, is that increased reimbursement or enhanced reimbursement justified through either better outcomes or improved access where there was no access before? The representatives from the federally qualified health clinics gave me some information, and I believe it was copied to you as well. That say that the answer to those questions is absolutely yes. I haven't read that information. It was given to me this morning, but I simply am raising the issue.
I might just add that when we go into session next time, I think we need to thoroughly vet the whole concept of the federally qualified health centers, since they are becoming such a focus of the federal government. And so if the federal government is seeing them as a kind of the choice facility or means of providing care for a lot of poor across the country and are willing to provide additional money as well to help promote that, then I think the FQHCs should be a part of our plan for the entire state and not merely, and also it's out there, but it's not really an integrated part of what we're doing. It needs to be part of the full service picture, I think, for our state.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. And again, my intent was to lift this question from the page and put it out on the record. The question being raised is legitimate, but what we are lacking at this moment is a mechanism to have that conversation, that thorough vetting that you're speaking of, that does need to carry over into the next legislative session so that we can be clear about, in response to the question, are there better services? How do we know that? Superior outcomes or not? How do we know that? Reduced expenditures? Again, how do we know that? I appreciate that we have the letter from the Oregon Primary Care Association in front of us that was presented to us this morning. The information is part of the picture, part of a response, part of an answer, but we do need to have a much more thorough discussion, in my view.
Well, certainly we do.
Chair Richardson, Senator Gordley, just want to interject that we have a safety net advisory council that we established this past about a little over a year ago to actually begin to address at a statewide level issues of the healthcare safety net in its entirety, the role it plays, the policies we need to either to support it, and I think it would be a very appropriate task for that group to actually come back and provide a report on the healthcare safety net, federally qualified health centers, rural health clinics. This is an important part of our healthcare delivery system, and also a complex one in terms of an ability to talk about in a moment or two today. So I can ask that group to begin to prepare something.
You know, we have policy committees in the interim that one on the Oregon Health Plan, and this certainly would be dovetailed into that area, and it may be appropriate for us to ask for them to take this up at one of their hearings and get some additional information and get that started, the dialogue started during this interim, so we don't wait till next January.
And Mr. Chair, I would agree that we need to move in that direction and not only talk about that, but Mr. Britton raised some interesting questions, I think, in his narrative, and that is talking about better service, superior outcomes, and reduced expenditures, which also gets us into the realm of the cost comparison issue that I think this body raised a few sessions ago. And when the report came out, it still did not deal with apples to apples and oranges to oranges. And I think that any assessment, if you will, that looks at both the issue of quality and outcomes and cost comparison must also look at whether or not we're talking apples to apples and oranges. And I'm thinking now of managed care organizations versus fee-for-service and what it's costing us in each component. And if inside of that you're not getting the apples to apples and oranges to oranges, we're not really getting a full clear picture of both the cost as well as the outcome. And I put that on record because we've been struggling with getting that kind of data.
Thank you.
Representative Richardson, I just want to take one moment to respond to the previous point Representative Hanna made just about the information that you get as a committee. We spend a lot of time putting together the information, and as I sat here and heard your comment, I think what we might consider is at some point in the near future offline talking about the how we can provide you with the information in a better form that you'll use. Because I think we haven't had that discussion, and I think it would be beneficial to all of us. So
appropriate to evaluate.
That'd be great.
Thank you. Mr. Todd.
I'm on page 11 and was going to just mention on item 14, the Oregon State Hospital and Eastern Oregon have higher costs related to Smith Oregon State Hospital, the greater fuel and utility costs, and higher drug costs at EOPC. Item 16 is, well, I'll mention item 15 is the lease item that Bob had mentioned in his presentation. That's that increase. Item 16 is related to public health, the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. That program has seen significant growth in the last year or so, and so that's reflective there. And on page 12, there are two additional items related to positions within public health, related to public health preparedness, Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Act compliance, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and other ongoing grants. So it was a total of about 23 positions that they were requesting.
I'd like to just focus for a moment on the 10 positions for public health preparedness. Last week I was able to attend the summit up in Portland relating to the avian flu possibility, and we haven't spent as a state enough focus and attention on assuring that our public care facility, which is like a primary purpose of government, as we should have in the past, and the preparation that we do for some potential pandemic flu or something like that also will help us prepare for possible terrorist actions or natural catastrophe or anything else. And so this is it's a timely increase, and it's certainly appropriate.
Chair Richardson, I think it points out, first, these are other funds and federal funds, and that historically we haven't provided the kind of infrastructure funding for our public health system from our general fund dollars, and I think that's certainly an issue we need to look at in the next biennium, as we've discussed.
The reason I bring it up is that it's all tax money as far as I'm concerned, so whether it's other funds or federal funds, it's not like it's something else. I mean, it's money. It just may not be coming from Oregon, but it's coming from the people, and so we have a responsibility, I think, to make sure that we spend appropriately the money that's available from the federal government, even if they're not watching it. You know, we need to be very careful with that, and in this instance, I think that's something that I'm glad the federal government is priming that pump, and that we need to follow up with it and assure that that it goes forward.
The next item, which I'll call 16C since I stopped numbering, is public health requesting the use of the additional tobacco tax revenue related to expansion of the tobacco cessation activities. On page 13, the issue I think that I'll point out to you that's new really is item number 4, and that's related to the costs that we have and incur related to actuarial services activities. As we continue to move more into managed care, we have more and more activity related to having actuarial work done, and that work is not anticipated in the ledge adopted budget. And then item 5 on page 14 is the costs related to the positions for the expansion of the estates and overpayment recovery units. And those are our other funds and federal funds. So with that, I'll stop.
All right, thank you. Are there questions on these items?
Very brief one.
There's a Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The estate's overpayment, is that where the state is paying like somebody in the home to help take care of somebody and against the eventual death, and then you go back to their estate and collect? Is that what that is?
Representative Richardson, Representative Barker, essentially yes, that is
okay,
correct.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Keshner, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Are you asking for my recommendation?
Your recommendation or any comments you have as well?
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I really don't have additional comments. I know that LFO will probably walk through in detail the recommendation, and I just want to say that the Department of Administrative Services originally recommended to defer this request, knowing that there will be opportunities in the near future probably to look at how we might address particularly the general fund issues. In looking at LFO's recommendation ourselves, we do concur with what LFO is about to recommend in terms of dealing with some of the technical issues and some limitation increases.
Thank you. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our recommendations are summarized on page 1311. 1311. At the top of the page is a recommendation, or is a chart showing our recommendation with respect to some general fund changes and other funds and federal funds, position authority, and FTE increases. I want to go over those just a bit. In general, our general fund changes are technical in nature. That is, they net to zero, for one thing. We're not recommending the addition of general fund at this point in time. That will need to be done in a special session, or I suppose in a regular session in January of 2007, hopefully sooner. But the general fund changes are, as I said, technical in nature. The other funds and federal funds expenditure limitation increases were those throughout the rebalance that, in Ms. Baker's judgment and my judgment, had absolutely nothing to do with general fund. That is, if there is a caseload change, for example, that requires general fund and then there's related federal match, that is not in these numbers. These are, for example, grant changes where there is no general fund match required. The department is aware of a grant that they've received. They need additional limitation to spend it. We're recommending to go ahead and make those particular kinds of changes. But as I said, there are no other funds or federal funds changes in here that are in any way associated with general fund. The position changes are more than simply technical in nature. They are described throughout our analysis in the sections that they pertain to. I would point out that health services, we would propose increasing positions 23, 13.18 FTE. As Representative Richardson mentioned, they include 10 positions related to public health preparedness. We've outlined all of the positions on 13.8 with respect to health services, 13.10 with respect to the seniors and people with disabilities. We also have discussed in here kind of an approach that we could take, that the legislature could take with respect to a special session. As we've noted here, and as you all know, the emergency board doesn't have $136 million of general fund to allocate to the department today or tomorrow, and that would need to be done most likely in a special session. we are recommending or would probably be recommending in that special session, and we've had some preliminary conversations with legislative leadership about this, to directly appropriate general fund to the agency to fully cover the federal match rate issue and the 2003-05 closeout roll-up costs. We view these as fairly as certain as we can be at this point in time. We don't believe that they're going to change, and we would recommend simply allocating those or making an appropriation of general fund to the agency to take care of those particular issues. We within the next two bullets directly appropriate additional general fund to the agency to partially cover the projected program caseload and cost increases identified in the April rebalance, but also in the third bullet appropriate some of that for caseload and cost per case issues as a special purpose appropriation to the emergency board so that it could have some jurisdiction, if you will, over or be able to respond, more accurately, be able to respond to caseload changes. As Dr. Goldberg said, the $136.2 million will change, and we have a few indications of where it might change already. But we would propose providing enough to the emergency board that it could respond to those changes, allocate the money if necessary, or retain it if it were not necessary. We've made a fourth bullet here to, again, Dr. Goldberg mentioned, perhaps enact other legislation, either perhaps in special session, but perhaps in a regular session, that would help the agency address the critical organizational and management issues that Dr. Goldberg spent time talking about earlier. One other recommendation that we mentioned in the health services discussion relates to some additional tobacco tax. This is other funds expenditure limitation, and it is not part of our recommendation up above in this chart within the health services other funds limitation increase. But the proposal is that the department be able to spend about $633,000 of additional tobacco tax within its tobacco prevention education and education program. And we're not opposed to that idea. However, we are making a recommendation that the emergency board request the Department of Human Services to refrain from spending that money until we have a final plan for the rebalance. The reason is that that money could be shifted by the full legislature to the Oregon Health Plan and used in lieu of general fund, thereby decreasing the shortfall by about $633,000. But that's a decision that the full legislature would have to make. But if the money has already been spent, it can't make that decision. Okay. Sheila, do you have any other points to make on this?
No, I think that was a good summary. We are, as John noted, at this time recommending the emergency board just make the general fund transfers and increase the other funds, federal funds expenditure limitation, and make the position adjustments as noted in that table.
Are there questions for either John or Sheila? If not, Mr. Hannah?
Well, yes, I would. This would be a difficult motion to make, but
you made a great one. I wish we could have written down what you said.
my motion would be to accept the recommendation as finally outlined by our LFO analysts.
Representative Hannah has moved that we accept LFO recommendations as detailed by Mr. Britton and summarized by Ms. Baker. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered, and I will carry this one. Thank you very much for that report and for the progress that's being made as we not only have to deal with a shortfall, but that we try and identify causes and solutions that will have long-term effect and benefit for DHS and for Oregon.
All right, moving along. Now we'll go to agency request number 15, Office of Private Health Partnerships, FEOP maintenance of effort requirement. Mr. Moore, this time I'll call on you. I won't forget. Okay, we can go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Rocky King, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Private Health Partnerships, which is formerly the Insurance Pool Governing Board, referred to as IPGB. The issue before us today is not a new one. If you recall, we came to you in November, again in January, and so this is our third visit in April. I don't want to belabor a lot of the details unless there are questions, but let me just give you a quick summary. If you recall, we have a maintenance of effort requirement within FEOP program, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, of about $40.2 million that must be spent in over a five-year period. And during the budget deliberations last session, the legislature specifically set aside $4 million in a special appropriation account and directed the executive branch to, and specifically Department of Human Services, to go to CMS and ask for flexibility in using $4 million of that MOE requirement in DHS-specific health programs, for example, the Children's Health Insurance Program or Standard or some combination of that. Really what the legislature is asking for is find out if we have flexibility, either part or all, to see to the DHS programs or to leave some in FEOP. And it was really a flexibility issue that you were looking for. We didn't have an answer by November of this last year, so you chose to allocate $2.9 million of that $4 million to FEOP, the Office of Private Health Partnerships, to serve those people who either had an application in hand or those people that had an application that had already been sent to us and we were in the process of reviewing. At that point, we said if we closed new enrollments to individual market at that point, we would run between 16,500 and 17,000 enrollment. We actually peaked at 16,700 and have since that time started to come down, not allowing any new applications for the individual market, but continuing to enroll people as they became eligible if they had group-based coverage available to them. Since November, where we had zero on a waiting list, we now have built up to about a little over 17,300 on the waiting list, people who have asked for applications, but because the program's closed, we have not been able to provide them for that. We did not receive an answer by the January e-board, so you voted to defer this until April. And when we wrote the letter to you about a month ago when it was due, we had still not received any word from CMS. And thus, the executive branch was recommending at that point that the $1.1 million remaining general fund in the SPA be allocated to the Office of Private Health Partnerships and also the federal funds limitation. However, in the last, we'll say minutes, but it's really been last 3 hours. We have had some communications from CMS and Lynn Reed, who is the interim administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. We'll talk about that. That really revisits the priority and I think the recommendation that the governor and the executive branch are making relative to the remaining $1.1 million. So with that, I'm going to have Lynn get back.
Thank you.
Lim Reed, Interim Assistant Director for Medical Assistance Programs. Indeed, this morning at between 5 and 6 a.m., we did receive from CMS official word in terms of both an email communication from the regional director, James Whitfield, and then a letter from central office CMS that they will be approving our maintenance of effort flexibility request. And yesterday they sent to us some draft terms and conditions, which are a critical piece of knowing how that might be administered from their perspective. And we find that those appear to be acceptable to us, that they don't have onerous reporting requirements in them. As a result, then, the executive branch is recommending to the e-board that you would appropriate the remainder of the special purpose allocation to DHS to implement the number one priority that had been identified in the e-board letter and previous letters, and that would be expanding eligibility for children in the Children's Health Insurance Program from a 6-month period of eligibility to a 12-month period of eligibility. That continues to be a top priority for us in the executive branch. Were it implemented on June 1st, which it could be, were you to make the allocation at this e-board, about 9,000 kids would be served in that program by the end of the biennium. Obviously, as Mr. Britton has pointed out, there are costs then that roll forward into the next biennium. If for some reason it were not possible to implement the extended period of eligibility for CHIP kids, then DHS would take steps to implement the second priority, were that your direction, and that would take children in CHIP from 185% of the federal poverty level up to 200% of the federal poverty level. That second priority item would serve about 1,400 kids by the end of the biennium, so a lesser number of kids would be coming into the program. And then we would suggest that should you take this action, that you might want us to report to the e-board in June in terms of the actions that we were actually taken.
Well, changing events.
Absolutely. It was down to the wire.
Senator Winner.
I just would like to be very comfortable in having documents in hand. I'm kind of... and if Lynn has from CMS and what our requirements would be under the instruction from CMS, like, you know, one of the things you learn on this side of the aisle is that the devil is in the detail, and if you don't have the detail, we sometimes get ourselves into some hot water later. So...
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the two pieces of paper that are being handed out right now are the two notices of approval that we received this morning. Although I think, Senator Winters, you may be looking more to the 27-page terms and conditions document.
You got it.
And certainly we can make that available.
And I say that because it's all indications that looks like we're going forward anyway to take additional action on budget items shortly, and I just want to make certain that we have all of our I's dotted and our T's crossed before making a decision. That's just me personally.
Okay. Certainly this changes recommendations. Our committee does not need to necessarily go forward with a recommendation to release the 1.1 for additional policies, especially we do have this lingering concern that the funding for this biennium for the Office of Private Health Partnerships is much higher than it's been in prior bienniums as a result of needs for maintenance of effort and other concerns, and there is a major
question as to the availability of funds in the next biennium budget cycle to maintain the levels that we're at even presently. We have the option of just saying, well, great, we got a letter. It's not a final letter. It came in. It was faxed to us this morning. We've got 22 seconds. We can look it over. And so let's allocate $1.1 million based on that. Or we could defer until the June e-board and have it be considered more carefully. And I'm open for considerations on those options or any other options you might see. Senator Gordon.
Mr. Chair, I frankly would be comfortable moving forward with what the executive branch and DHS are proposing to do. The one question I have, though, is around what barriers might there be to meeting the first priority? Because I heard a suggestion in Ms. Reed's comments that there might be a problem meeting the first priority. I kind of picked that up. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I didn't mean to imply that there might be a problem in terms of our implementing it or in terms of the terms and conditions document that we received. It was more a reference to should this body want to choose a different alternative, that would be our second priority from an executive branch perspective.
By the way, I received a copy of the letter before the meeting, so it's not like this is new to me, but some of you may not have received that, and we haven't received both of these sheets. Mr. Britton, why don't you tell us where you think LFO is and just what your feelings are on this, what kind of recommendations?
Mr. Chair and members, our recommendation hasn't changed from what we've written. I'm frankly surprised that we got a response from CMS. I didn't think we would get one by this e-board. However, our analysis does say that if we did get an unexpected positive response, that we would recommend that you go ahead and either allocate the money to FEOP, kind of a known quantity, or otherwise defer action until you can evaluate what you need to evaluate until June, as far as either making a decision to allocate it to the FEOP program or otherwise making a decision to allocate it to DHS for one of the two priorities that Ms. Reed identified.
Does that mean, Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordon.
In what has just been said, does that mean that we would then, if we took that that path, we would miss an opportunity to provide funding and services for 9,000 children?
I think she said that the 9,000 would be what the ramp-up would be in enrollment by the end of the biennium.
Correct.
Not a loss of 9,000. It would delay the implementation of the availability of the additional coverage for 2 months.
That's correct.
Two and a half months. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, would the $1.1 million infusion to FEOP alleviate any kind of a waiting list, or have you been able to fully use that? Are you out of money now, or are you waiting for the $1.1 million to go on? And then, you know, to John, is a 60, 80, 90 day delay in CHIP funding, it's somewhat to Senator Gorley's question, can we still ramp that up and get there to the 9,000 if we deferred? So one at a time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, first of all the figures I'm about to give you depend on when you implement and how long it takes to get people on it and what the mix of those are, whether it's children, because we serve children and adults in FEOP. But we would anticipate if you gave us the $1.1 million, meaning FEOP, that we would open up within the next week and be able to serve over the next 3 or 4 months. It would take people to come in between 1,500 and 2,000 people that are on the waiting list, which is a little over 17,000 now. And that's for the remainder of the biennium. We would be able to maintain that level.
Mr. Chair, could we clarify, is it people or families? for people and families.
Ms. Chair, Senator Gordley, out of those 17,000, you probably have between 7,500 and 8,000 families, so that includes both children and adults.
And so the 1,500 to 2,000 that you're speaking of?
Are individuals.
Individuals.
Right.
Not children?
It would include some children, yes.
Okay.
Senator Gordley.
Follow-up? No. I guess, yes, follow-up. John, what are your thoughts on the ramp-up process within the CHIP program if you deferred? I mean, can we still get to 9,000?
If we waited 2 months?
My understanding, and I would look to Lynn or anybody else for correction on this, but my understanding is, and our chart shows the roll-up costs for 07-09, but that if you, and these are representative of a June allocation date, that you still could reach close to 9,000, if not reach 9,000 by the end of biennium. But I don't know that for a fact.
Ms. Reed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I couldn't give you the definitive number. It will probably be some fewer individuals by the end of the biennium, but then it doesn't lessen our overall pool that will eventually come onto the program. It would just move that ramp up out a couple of months
right
into the next biennium.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm asking you, you want this now, to move that money into the CHIP, is what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, yes, it is our request that the allocation be made now in order to move forward right away.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question, because there's a little, I always say the devil's in the detail. And in, Gene, in the letter that you've received, Lynn, there's a little line in there that says, please note that your requested changes regarding the benefit package remains under review. What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we have three pending waiver requests with CMS. One of them are benefit reductions that come out of the legislative adopted budget. Those include, and that's the one that is still under review. That includes changes, reductions to vision, over-the-counter drugs, hospital days, and a fourth item I've just forgotten. The second waiver request, which would be approved along with this flexibility, is related to premiums. Senate Bill 782 required us to change the premium structure for OHP standard. That was another one of the pending waiver requests, and that is also a piece of what's moving forward in this package, and then the flexibility here.
Well, in evaluating these kinds of things, certainly we have the balance. We'd like to see additional coverage for children. We also are talking about $1.1 million, and we're about to make a decision based on a fax letter that is a preliminary letter, not a final letter, and on a 27-page terms and conditions, which were only received yesterday. And it's it is kind of a snap decision to do it. And while the end may be an appropriate end, it's a judgment issue as to whether or not we ought to just move ahead when things are happening so quickly and we don't have a thorough evaluation of what's, what the consequences are going to be. I can see that we may not agree on this, but and like I say, I could argue. I'm a lawyer, right? I could argue it either way. My own opinion is we ought to
as much as I, and I really do support, because Oregon has, we have statutorily said we're going to fund children up to 200% of poverty, and where I want to go there. But I also understand the federal process, and you've got this 27-page document, and I don't want to rush to where we actually end up having a problem. And I would like some vetting time to look to see what we're getting into.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll accept a motion from you, and then we can discuss the motion. And
I would move that I believe that Mr. Britton, part of his motion was to give us some time to look at this before moving forward.
Actually, I think the motion would be we do not accept his recommendation that the money go to FEOP, or that
that's right.
To that. So we do not support that recommendation, but in place of it, we move to defer a decision on this $1.1 million until the next board. Okay. So is that your motion?
That's my motion.
Senator Winters has moved that we not accept LFO recommendations on the distribution of the $1.1 million to the Office of Private Health Partnership, but instead that we take no action on releasing this $1.1 million and that we carry it over as an item for the next e-board. Is there discussion on the motion?
I'm going to vote against that just because I want to really flag. We've got to get the people insured as quickly as possible. I had, you know, at the end of the last session, I ended up in the hospital for a couple of days. Fortunately, I was insured. The bill for that was $14,000. And I don't want somebody, especially a child, not getting medical treatment because they don't have insurance. So, and I appreciate the position of wanting to take a real close look at the devil in the details.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Representative Barker's position there. I think this is one of those tough decisions. If I had to decide and just in a snap decision, which I don't think I have to, but if I had to, I'd probably lean towards getting the money into the CHIP program because I think we need to get there with it eventually. But I don't like to feel like we could potentially make a decision here without some detail, level of detail that, though we would immediately help some folks, we could also put ourselves in jeopardy in terms of longer-term funding to the program. And so I think I can support Senator Winter's motion that we look a little more carefully at this, get the details worked out, and then move forward with the correct decision.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I
Senator Gordon.
Wish to be identified with the remarks made by my good colleague, Representative Barker, just feeling a sense of urgency, understanding what the critical needs are out there around our great state. And I still remember Mr. Schmidt, Douglas Schmidt, and his lingering in a coma and finally dying, and, you know, as a result of public policy decisions made in this building. So I that's where I am.
Okay, thank you. Actually, procedurally, we should have a roll call on the vote because it's not unanimous. And so I'll go ahead and ask that clerk call roll.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
No.
Representative Hannah.
Aye.
Senator Gordley.
No.
Senator Winter.
Aye.
Chair Richardson.
Aye. So the motion carries, and Senator Winters, if you'd carry it tomorrow.
Okay.
And everything that's been said, you know, we all understand what's at stake, and we appreciate very much the mm-hmm. positions and the and I didn't ask for recommendations after all.
Yeah.
Do you have any post comments you'd like to make?
First out of the
before I drop.
I do too.
All right, so the motion carries. Things kind of moved in this one, a little different than normal.
Yeah.
And I hear you.
It's very direct. It's a tough one, and I think we're still going to get into something.
All right, we can move fairly quickly. We have item 16.
I'm hungry.
Health-related licensing boards.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
Hello there.
Ms. Deborah Manthe is now at our table. Ready to roll.
You're up.
Good morning.
Actually, afternoon.
Mr. Chair and members, afternoon.
We're an OT.
I'm Lori Mockinen, Director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and I'm speaking on behalf of the seven boards that are represented in the report that we have submitted to you. We are asking that you merely accept the report We're asking that you merely accept the report. We're not asking for an evaluation or comments at this time.
Okay. Recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly Friels with the Department of Administrative Services. Essentially, this report is to give the governor and the Legislative Assembly, when they meet next time, some options on how to craft the budget, the 07-09 budget, for these seven agencies. And so what the report did was give you four different options, identified some advantages and disadvantages of each of those options with the understanding that would give you a better context for the decision-making process.
Ms. Manthey, your recommendation?
Mr. Chair, members, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that you acknowledge receipt of the report with no recommendation as to a preferred option.
Okay. We appreciate the report. We've read it. And accept the motion acknowledging receipt of the report.
Moved.
Representative Barker has moved that we acknowledge receipt of this report, which is item 16 on our agenda, relating to health-related licensing boards. Is there objection?
No objection, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Where does the Board of Nursing fit into the mix?
Board of Nursing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we're not associated with the Board of Nursing. We're
smaller.
Separate. We're all independent, not independent. We're autonomous agencies. We have one budget number, so when our budget goes to the full committee, it's under one number. But in the past, we have, as you might remember, presented our budgets separately.
I wasn't clear in my question. The Board of Nursing seems to fall outside of the two high-level. We have high-level health-related licensing boards. You're not on that list. And then we have the seven health-related licensing boards to be consolidated into an administrative structure. They're not on that list either. And so my question is, where do they fit in the mix?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, when we were looking at this during session and the issue was focused around health-related licensing boards with three or fewer FTE, and it started with the group that we refer to as the health-related licensing boards, and these are those. And you are correct. Board of Nursing, medical examiners fall outside that grouping of health-related licensing boards, and so they're not reflected in any of the information that I gave you.
Okay. Further discussion?
Thank you.
Is there objection? Hearing none, we acknowledge receipt of the report. Thank you. Final item is item 7.
Carrier?
Oh, Carrier. Deborah. Jenny Parker.
Great. Thank you.
Item 17, Commission of the Blind. Main office building repair, partial renovation and technology upgrade. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Mock, and I am administrator of the Commission for the Blind. And we are here today to ask for an increase in our federal and other limitation. And I'm going to ask the chair of the commission board, Don Dart, to give the background on that request.
Welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Mock. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mike Leith from the agency, Director of Administrative Services, is also here this afternoon.
Okay, would you identify yourself also?
Oh, I'm sorry, Donald Dart. I'm chairman of the commission.
Thank you.
I'm happy to say that we haven't been here before, and I'm more pleased to say that we're here on a request that will cost the state no money. As Linda indicated, we're here to request an increase in our limitation in order to take advantage of some federal matching funds, and our portion of that match will be entirely from other funds. Specifically, and I might add that we have this opportunity now because the Office of Voc Rehab Services was not able to take advantage of the matching funds, and fortunately our commission is in a position to do so at this time. Specifically, we are asking that we be allowed to use approximately $400,000 from the agency's donation account, which is about a quarter of that account, in order to obtain federal matching funds on approximately a 4-to-1 match basis. Those funds would be used primarily in three general areas. One is repair and maintenance for our facility, the agency's main center in Portland. Secondly is remodeling and reconfiguring part of the interior of that building. And thirdly, we would also like to be able to purchase computer and other equipment for our technology center in our building. I'm going to leave it to Ms. Mock to answer any specific questions about what's involved in each of those projects, and I would leave it to Mr. Leith to answer any questions about specifically what amounts we propose to be spent in each of those categories. I would like to just say a couple of things briefly. I know it has been many years since any member of the legislature has visited our building in Portland. If you were to do so, you would notice a dry rot problem on the exterior of the building. When you entered the lobby, you would notice that our very old HVAC system, quite frankly, doesn't HVAC very well. And if it were one of those rare days when it rained in Portland, you would notice we have a leaky roof with containers on the floor in parts of the building to catch the water. This is a building in disrepair and badly in need of attention. And I mention those items only to point out that we're not suggesting anything that is remotely extravagant here. We're trying to maintain the basic integrity of our building and to reconfigure part of the interior in order to make it much more appropriate to meet the needs of our clients. I would also say, although it should be apparent, I think it's worth mentioning that if this proposal is approved, it not only would mean that no state funds would be used at this time to meet these needs, but in the next biennium, no real budget dollars would have to be taken out to address these needs. And of course, if they were, that would have a direct effect upon the services we render to our clients. This is a proposal that, quite frankly, I don't see has a downside. We're not asking for state money, merely to take advantage of existing matching funds on the federal side.
Thank you, Mr. Nard. We've looked at the materials that have been provided for us, and I think everything you've said is certainly accurate and correct. And so we are glad that you would bring this forward. We are glad that we're going to get an opportunity to vote on this. Are there questions?
Thank you. I will come out and visit the Commission for the Blind office next week, if that can be accommodated. I'd like to do that, hearing that legislators haven't been out to visit you for quite a while.
Usually they don't necessarily ask for this committee to come show up. It happened last session, but still.
But I also have something in mind that I'd like to talk to you about as well. The chair mentioned earlier under another agenda item that the state is becoming more focused on the need to prepare for an emergency, whether it be a natural or man-made disaster. And one of the things I'm aware of is that we need to look very carefully at the needs of, I'll say, special needs populations. And we need your help helping us do that. In the event of earthquake, avian flu, whatever it might be, we need to make sure that we're reaching all of our Oregon communities. So when I come to visit you, I'll have that conversation in mind. And thank you for letting us know that we haven't been around for a while.
Thank you, Senator. We usually don't solicit attention from the legislature, but it would be nice. We're very proud of the people we have there and the work that we're doing. We'd love to have you visit.
Great.
Other questions? Or
just the only other comment I have, and just looking at the address, I can recall walking by that building on my way to Benson High School back in the 50s. Mm. I'm surprised you're still in it.
Not much has changed.
Only you have changed.
Yeah. I changed a lot.
Is it Ms. Clymer?
Kleiner? Yes.
Welcome in front of this committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Erica Kleiner from the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend approval of the request with modification of the expenditure limitation as capital construction.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Matthew?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We also are recommending approval of the request. However, we are not recommending it be a capital construction limitation. I think the the instructions around capital projects and the budget instructions are fairly gray, and I think reasonable people reading these and looking at the detail of this request can come to a difference of opinion, and that's what we have here. And so our recommendation is to approve the request as it was requested. $1,506,192 increase in the federal fund expenditure limitation and a $407,648 increase to their other funds expenditure limitation.
Thank you. Knowing who we deal with on a daily basis, we appreciate very much the fact that both BAM and LFO are making similar recommendation as far as the technicality as to how it should be listed. I would accept a motion that would accept the recommendation from LFO. Like to make it?
So move that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Gordley has moved that we accept the LFO recommendation as described. Is there discussion? Representative Hanna.
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain of the legalities about disclosure. Is that important at this?
It would be fine.
Okay, well, let me just...
It's always appropriate.
Yeah, I think it is appropriate. I'm a member of a limited liability corporation that does vending sales and service contracts with related parties to the Commission for the Blind.
Okay. Do you have any direct financial involvement in the matter before the committee?
No.
Okay. So noted. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, thank you very much for coming, and the motion carries, and we'll move forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And is there other matters that need to come up before this committee?
Do you need a carrier?
I need a carrier. Was I going to carry? Senator Gordy is going to be carrying that. Having seeing no further matters, and if there's no objection, we stand adjourned.